That's good.
Yeah, but he's just saying a lot. He's been doing a lot of
You want to mention this in your report, that these are available?
Sure. Either way, whatever you like to do. Yes.
You guys are ready?
Yes.
So,
there's such a need everywhere.
Chris is on the subsidy.
Okay, thank you.
What's Chris Ross on the subsidy?
Yeah. So we got quorum.
Yes, you do.
I think I'm okay. So I'll tell them my story. Tell them how
I'm going to whoever it is.
A couple of you'll get
Let him get Wallington's
Someone else coming over and say hello to here.
Should we tell him to bring him in on the spot? Because, you know,
yeah, I know.
Is it going to talk? Can't we do the hunt?
He'll talk with
So Ross is like, Arnold Sultan says this, and there won't be a chance to deal with
it. You're starting there.
Yeah,
there
we go. If the problem is that they say, a real tough strategy,
I understand.
Not this.
Good morning. I call to order this 34th meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingart. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
Jack Schreier, Morris County Freeholder.
Tim Dillian, I'm a public member. I live in Hopewell Borough in Mercer County.
Liz Calabrese, Bergen County Freeholder.
Scott Whitenack, public member of Morristown.
Michael Solovar, out of Bernardsville, councilperson, Somerset County.
Amy Les, Persephone.
Tracy Coraluccio, public member, Hunterdon County.
And Glenn Vetrano, Suffolk County. On cue. We're expecting several other members a little bit later. This meeting has been advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act, and in particular publicized on the Highlands Council's website. All who wish, please rise and place the allegiance.
To the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have the minutes of our last meeting from last week.
I'll move the minutes.
For a second?
Second.
Any comments or corrections? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstention?
Stay.
We can't pass it. Okay, I'm sorry. We don't have quite enough people, so we'll do that a little bit later. You all have the agenda. A couple of things to report. As far as I know, we have no surprises planned for today's meeting. Less eventful than last week's. It's very likely that by next week's meeting we will have two new members of the council. Tahisha Way, who is here today, and Eric Peterson were approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee this week and are scheduled to be considered by the full Senate on Monday. So all those well, they will be members of the council by our next meeting, which is next Thursday at 10 o'clock. In your packets are a number of things. There are written comments we've received from the Potomac River Coalition in the packet, and also written comments from the Farm Bureau, both there. Following last week's work session, we had a public comment period, and there is a summary of all the comments that were said, spoken at that session. There is also a brochure for a regional planning conference in New Jersey, which is next Thursday and Friday. So Thursday part conflicts with our meeting. And the groups putting that together have specifically wanted me to encourage council members to come if they would like to, and it's also open to anyone else in the public who would like to go. Also in our packet is two letters to Governor Corzine, one thanking him for coming here last week, and the other more substantive on the Garden State Preservation Trust and the position the council has taken consistently that needs to be funded at a higher level with special regard to the Highlands. So you will see that. And that letter grew out of the committee that Debbie Pasquarelli was chairing. This meeting, like the two previous ones, is a workshop session of the council, so we will focus on specific issues that are on the agenda. There are five issues on the agenda, but we'll only get to four of them. The issue paper on smart design standards, I guess, is not quite ready for our review. So we will have four of them, and as we've done the past 2 weeks, we will have a public comment session at the close of this meeting. We'll end no later than 4 o'clock if we somehow get through the agenda before that. No one will object, I'm sure. And then after we close the meeting, there's a committee workshop, and we'll have a public comment session. There's also a committee meeting after that, but anyone who wants to speak at that comment session is encouraged to do so, and for members who can't stay, those comments, like the ones from last week, will be summarized and made available to all members of the council. That's my report. Other council members have anything they'd like to say at this point? Okay, Dante. Oh, one other thing I did want to mention. I'm sorry. Also, I think it made it in the packet. Is press release? Did that make it in the packet or no? Okay, there is a press release that's going out today, announcing the grants the council's making available for agricultural projects. Grants can be applied for by municipalities in the Highlands, the seven Highland counties, or county agricultural development boards. This is a project. Program the council approved several months ago, and the press release explains that these grant the applications can are due anytime between now and January 1st. There's more information about it on the council's website, and there will be letters going out from the council to all the municipalities, counties, and county agricultural boards. Highlighting the availability of these funds, but anyone on the council or anyone else in the room who knows of projects or people who might be interested in jurisdictions that might be interested in applying for these funds, at least encourage them to do so.
Mr. Chairman, did you want to do any of the committee reports at this time or later?
They're on the agenda after your report, so we'll do your report.
Okay, very good. The only item that I have to mention is that we have an engineer who's getting ready to start in the next several weeks, and that should help us with our not only our the rest of our plan development piece, but as we begin to work toward our guidelines and standards, it'll happen. And then, obviously, ultimately, our regulatory review of applications that come in. So that's good news, and we're moving forward. Thank you.
We have some committee reports. I guess we can now consider the minutes. We have a quorum of people who were here at last week's meeting. So there was a motion on the floor to approve the minutes. And a second, Debbie, do you have any comments on this?
Not one comment.
Okay. All those in favor of the minutes?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstained.
Abstained. Okay, so the minutes are carried. Next item on the agenda, there are three committees. There are reports on that have been relatively recently, their summaries of their meetings are in the packet. Debbie, do you want to vote?
You can ask Mimi to go first.
Okay. You can catch your breath. Okay. Mimi Lex, the Local Participation Committee.
Okay, yes, Mr. Chairman. The committee met last Thursday prior to the council meeting. And given the fact that the act under which we operate requires that we have six public sessions, one in Trenton, prior to approval of the RPM. We focus primarily on determining where, when, and how we should conduct these meetings. And there were several venues suggested. One of the prime factors that we discussed was the need to have large rooms that we might have 200, 250 people, so we're looking for places that would accommodate 250 people or more. I believe Patty Sly has been following up on some of the suggestions that we made at that time for appropriate venues. We also discussed the time of day that we should have these things, and there's decided that some should be in the mornings or the day, some should be in the evening. Trying our best to accommodate everybody, and that the format would primarily consist of the staff giving a brief introduction and overview at the meetings, and then providing for as much comment time as possible. We also discussed the need that in order for these sessions to be as helpful to us as possible from the standpoint of public input, we should try our best to get information out to the public prior to the beginning of these sessions. So we suggested that we have some open time here at our office where staff would be available for the public to come and ask questions. We will be putting together CDs of the plan as rapidly as we can once the draft is approved and making that available to the public. We're also going to try to plan some sessions where we reach out to county officials and municipal officials to make them aware of the plan and seek their input as well.
And the committee is meeting again today after the public comment session after this meeting.
Yes.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Clear your breath.
Well, my breath, I'm a sip of water. I'm going to review the report from the Land Conservation Committee, which met on August the 8th. And I'd also suggest that if you look in your packet, you have a letter dated today to Governor Corzine, because this is, these two are related, if we can discuss with them at once, unless you have it elsewhere on the agenda. The Land Conservation Subcommittee met on August 8th. What primarily precipitated that meeting was the news that efforts had begun for reauthorization of the Garden State Preservation Trust. So the group met to discuss what activities, actions, positions that the council should consider taking relative to that effort. And if seeking the chair report, let me summarize for you the key points of which consensus was achieved, which are reflected in the letter to Governor Corzine that I referred to, and that is that we acknowledge the importance of the funds provided by the trust for preservation and conservation in the region which we oversee, the need for an extension of the 2009 sunset provision of the Highlands Act for the purposes of appraisals in determining Tree Highlands Act values relative, obviously, for compensation for lands conserved and preserved. Also, we had a discussion about the existing Green Acres, SADC, and SHPO program rules and how lands that we designate the Regional Master Plan for Conservation and Preservation, likely some of them will fall outside of the program's eligibility for the existing programs. And so we recommend that the trust broad, as we stated here, broaden its scope to include Highlands properties that fall outside those eligibility requirements for existing programs. And last but not least, we're suggesting funds being utilized from the trust to capitalize the impending Highlands TDOT program to establish the backing and everything like that. So we completed what our primary, with this letter going to the governor, we completed our immediate activities. We're asking an offer of governor assistance and reauthorization of the trust, and there's some other programs we'll be tackling as the year goes on. Any questions about that? And then we have the report from the Budget Finance Committee meeting of August 31st. We met, that was our first meeting after the completion of fiscal year 06. So we reviewed statement, fiscal year 06 financial statements, activities, reports. We also took time to review the funding history for the council since we're still in somewhat of a startup mode. And the various fiscal years and how funding was provided. We have a new staff member, Patty Sly, who's working with us, and it also served to bring her up to speed and get us all on the same page. And we're, in fact, putting together a historical document reflecting the funding history. And we'll update it as it goes forward so we all stay on the same page. We then turn to beginning development of the fiscal year 07 appropriations budget. Council members on the subcommittee received the details on as to what the state's 07 budget appropriated for our activities, where preliminary discussions about where we see an allocation of it. It's a $3 million appropriation, where we might be ultimately recommending to the council an appropriation for operating budget versus Regional Master Plan expense budget, reviewed a first draft of a operating, well, both of those budgets, and gave some direction to the staff to revise those, and then we will be coming together again to review them, and culminating with a budget to be presented to the council for approval. That is it.
Comments? Questions? Thank you. Let me introduce, recognize Eric Peterson, who just joined us. He'll, as I said before, all goes well, be a member of the council next week. We're going to turn now to the work session. On the agenda, there are five topics listed. One of them, as I mentioned, we will not discuss, and we will not, and the ones we on the agenda will discuss in a slightly different order. So we're going to start with steep slope areas and then go to forest resource areas, then groundwater recharge, and then introduction. There are copies of the issue papers in all our packets, and there are copies for anyone else in the room who doesn't have one on the table in the reception area where you came in. I'll turn this over to Dante.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As indicated by the chairman, we have copies for members of the public of our steep slope policy paper. In order to help the public follow along during our discussion, we on the staff level are going to try to reference each recommendation by number as we present it to the council as a way of assisting members in following along so that they can very familiar with the discussion and can participate as fully as possible during the public availability that follows. So today's staff presentation will be made by Steve Valzano and Chris Ross. So take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Dante. Before I get started and before I forget, I just want to extend gratitude to the staff for their extraordinary dedication and energy that they brought to this. We're in the third week of these work sessions, and it's required a very rapid transition from one subject to another, each with a great degree of complexity, and they've performed admirably, and I'm very proud of them. Secondly, too, I just want to express gratitude to two individuals that have been helping out in information that's going to be presented today. That is Ron Farr and Dag Madara from the North Jersey District Water Supply Commission. They have worked quietly in support of staff in the background at no cost or expense to the council, and their participation and input has been invaluable, and I extend my gratitude to them as well.
Are they here? Yes, are they here? Can
they
could stand up?
There's Ron, and I'm not sure if Ron will be going back chained to the desk shortly and dagging right now, so. But we'll next time Dag is in, we'll introduce him as well for members who haven't met him yet.
Just for purposes of introduction and clarity, as we get into steep slope and then some of the other resource constraints issues, there are essentially three things that we're trying to accomplish. Is one, to provide recommendations to council and to get input from council in terms of what constitutes the resource that we're describing. An example of slope, which we're going to discuss, is picking a percent and using that percent as the standard as we move forward. So defining what the resource is. Secondly, is describing how that resource informs the land use capability map, which is intended to define lands that are subject to more significant constraints on development from those that are more appropriate to accommodate future growth. And then thirdly is moving forward in conformance or through application review process is what are the standards that apply in order to protect that particular resource. And we're doing these resource-driven right now, and as a next step, we're going to start to integrate all the resource constraints as we move forward to the next step, which is pulling the draft plan together, talking about the land use capability map and the plan itself. But right now, we're concentrating on individual resources, defining what that resource is, defining how it informs the map, and defining what standards would apply to future protection of that resource moving forward. So with that said, I'm going to turn to the policy paper, steep slope protection requirements. I'm going to introduce each of the policy, and we'll carry it the same way I guess we did last meeting. It went very well. Policy recommendation number one is to recognize steep slope as an important required element of the regional master plan, recognize its use in developing the land use capability map, and recommending that the standard that is applied to guide future decisions establish a steep slope at or above 15%. That we've had some significant discussion in the past, particularly relating to the DEP rules. Within the preservation area, the DEP has standards that go from 10 above 10%. For planning purposes, what we're recommending in terms of informing the land use capability map, that we use 15% as the benchmark to identify lands that are significantly constrained. as we get into standards, we'll get into a discussion of what happens when you have a 10 to 15% slope. But staff recommendation too is to establish 15% slope or greater as steep slope for purposes of the land use capability map.
That was just something that I found confusing. You know, we talk about 10 to 20, then we talk about 15%. And I wasn't sure when we were talking about one or the other. Maybe the wording in this would clarify things better. Why, when you said 15% is the standard, why you drop down to 10?
Yeah. And why I did the introduction is that there are situations in which any change or where a lesser slope raises a resource management concern. So between 10 and 15%, there are concerns associated with disturbance of clearing of vegetation or disturbance of soils on those slopes when they're in close proximity to a surface water feature. We get into that or address that during site plan or smart design standards that are applied on a site plan level. But for purposes of planning for the region, identifying constraints of lands that are appropriate or inappropriate for development, 15% is felt to be more reasonable and more defensible.
Maybe it's somewhere in all the verbiage that could just be clarified.
Sure.
Are we contemplating having a lesser standard than that which the DEP currently has?
No, we are not. We're recognizing in the preservation area that the 10 to 20% standards in the DEP rules would apply. However, for purposes of identifying constraints throughout the region, we are using 15% as our guideline. So there are site design standards, and then there are regional planning standards.
So you'll never use 10 to 15% in the planning area? Is that what you're saying?
We will use 10 to 15% in the planning area at a site design level when that 10 to 15% is proximate to a surface water feature.
As long as we get that
correct. For the slopes that are 15 to 20%, they are covered by the DEP rules in the preservation area, or they're addressed to.
The DEP rules currently say between slopes of 10 to 20, you minimize alteration to that slope. With slopes greater than 20, you avoid any disturbance. That's generally the rule. The minimization allows for certain activities, including linear developments across that slope, such as a road or a driveway. What we're saying is that that rule will still apply in the preservation area. That rule will could apply in the planning area where that slope is near water.
That's what that's
yep. But for purposes of identifying slope constraints to inform the regional master plan, we're recommending that 15% be that planning standard.
In the planning area, are we going to quantify you said near water? Is it going to be when it's in the buffer or any time it's what we deem within effect of water.
And we're going to get into those discussions at the next meeting on open water and riparian, that the recommendation would be within that open water riparian protection area. And that will vary depending upon the quality of the receiving waterway.
Okay.
Steve, how is this blind to the line?
Well, it's blind to the line in the concept that from a regional planning context, when we identify lands that are constrained and otherwise inappropriate for development, that we are not applying a different standard between the preservation and planning area. However, on a site design level, we are recognizing that within the preservation area, there may be more stringent standards than apply in the than in the planning area, depending upon the nature of the resource. So, and this is a good example where there is the possibility that for blind-to-line planning concepts, uses one standard to identify land constraints. And then on a site design level, a more stringent standard in terms of protection of slope would apply to the preservation area than to the planning area.
A simple answer would be we're not blind to the line on a site-specific basis. And I guess the question, and you know I was on the other side of this question to start with, was why aren't we being blind to the line here?
In terms of developing the land use capability map, we are. We are. We are establishing a 15% slope and carrying that throughout the region.
And in trying to be practical, we're going to keep the planning area a little more liberal?
As it relates to slopes between 10 and 15%. This was a major subject of discussion that we had way back when we discussed the DEP rules and the restrictions that apply between 10 and 15%.
Well, if I take that as a given, then it does sound to me like we are less stringent than the DEP inside the preservation area.
No, because the DEP standards apply on a site design level. So they only apply on a particular property that is advanced for consideration for a variety of development activities that may conform to all the rules. That we are applying a regional standard to inform regionally and consistently across the region, regardless of whether it's in the preservation area or planning area, what lands constitute a significant resource constraint. And for that purpose, we're recommending 15%. So we're not less stringent than DEP rules because we'll apply those standards on a site level. But we are trying to be consistent across the region in terms of how we evaluate slope. And 10% from a planning perspective is very difficult to incorporate that standard into a planning concept because slope occurs in is distributed throughout the entire region. It's very hard.
This is not dissimilar to what a municipal planning board does. They start with an ordinance that identifies the steep slopes and defines them. And then, in cases where they believe it's appropriate, there's exceptions.
Yes.
Variances. So that's what you're talking about when you're talking about site specificity.
Yes.
But why isn't it a cleaner process to draw the land use capability map universe larger to include the lesser slopes and then to establish the standards? When you say inform the map, that doesn't give me a lot of clarity as to what policies are to follow from that. I remember the arguments about the slope, and fundamentally they are that you can engineer any controls that are necessary to deal with environmental impacts that come from altering those lesser slopes. I don't remember we resolved that. So can you just maybe clarify for me the inclusion of 10 to 15% into the land use capability map versus its exclusion, what that practically means in terms of the policies that are going to flow from it?
Yeah, the difficulty that we have with slope and the inclusion of slope in the land use capability map is that it is not a feature that's easily to define a specific area. It's very fragmented throughout the region, occurs everywhere in developed areas as well as undeveloped areas. We were and are continuing to develop a much more robust method for evaluating slope in the interest of advancing the plan to draft in October. We are going to pick a standard that is more easily incorporated into the map. When we get below 15%, it becomes very diffuse and very hard to nail down. Even above 15%, it becomes it is still problematic, and we're trying to work through it. And there's a provision here that recognizes that when you're close to a waterway, it's of greater significant concern. So for purposes of both practicality and to fulfill what we believe or adequately fulfill the goals and requirements of the Act, we feel that inclusion of 15% near water is the best way of addressing slope constraints on future development. And then during site plan, we can deal with the specifics with regard to sensitivity of slope at a lesser percent, the 10 to 15. It's more practical. It's a more practical approach.
What you just said is a much clearer rationale than was written here. So.
And fortunately, we're recording this, right. So I'll remember what I said.
Let me also get back to the question Mike was asking. You have essentially two identical sites with identical development proposed on them, one in the planning area and one in the preservation area. It does sound like, in terms of slope, we're going to address, or the recommendation is that we would address one differently from the other just because it's on one side of the line or the other. And I'm not
saying that's a good or bad thing, but I'm just trying to make sure that's right. I mean, that's my understanding.
And I believe that that is both true and it is appropriate, that between 10 and 15%, that restrictions should only apply. It shouldn't prohibit all uses. It should restrict use that is otherwise incompatible with or represents a threat to a water resource. Because that's the driver behind protection of slope, is increased rates of erosion and sedimentation to surface water features. And as such, if you have a 10% slope that's, you know, a distant from a water, isolated, it's easy to stabilize. Its alteration or disturbance of soil doesn't present a high degree of threat or a risk of erosion or sedimentation to a water resource. So at the lower percentages, it should be treated with differently, between 10 and 15%. The DEP rules apply the same standard between 10 and 20 and allow for row cuts, not only for 10% slopes that are distant from a waterway, but also 10% slopes that are proximate to a waterway. We feel that this is a much more reasonable and defensible approach to deal with slope and where slope protections are warranted. So we will provide relief.
So an accurate answer in terms of what the approach you're taking is that, in general, we're blind to the line, but because the Act treats the preservation area and planning sets slightly different standards for the two areas, the policy recommendations in some cases are going to be different in the planning area than the
Yes, and in some cases where there are differences, there are harmonization provisions that allow post-plan revisions to those standards so that they can be consistent across the region. So although they're different now and we're recommending different standards, there will be the opportunity to make them consistent through harmonization.
Just
to
I think we're dealing with something that is inherently confusing and complex, but it would help me and maybe it would help everybody else if you just explain a little bit clearer. We're really doing two things here, and that's what's not. I recognize we're doing two things. I can't explain it, but maybe you could explain it and it'll help everybody that what we're doing and what, when you say informing the land use map, what does that really mean? And it's to follow your analogy, Jack, it's sort of leading us to preparing a zoning map, turning zones.
Correct.
Like we do in a master plan. And then the next step is the ordinances, where we get very specific in how we enact that. So, but we're talking about them together here.
Yes.
So maybe you could
The regional master plan essentially has two major purposes or functions. One is the land use capability map, which identifies, consistent with the goals and requirements of the Act, where resources are, what constitutes a significant resource, what the effect of those resources are on development potential, and what protection measures are necessary to ensure that those resource values can be sustained over time. So in order to do that, we deal with that aspect that we have to define or divide the Highlands region into zones based upon their degree of constraint, degree of sensitivity, and regional significance. Using steep slope as an example, we are identifying the zone that has the greatest limitation to future development as including, not limited to, but as including slopes that are above a certain level. A staff recommendation is that level should be set at 15%. That's a good indication of where there's high risk of destabilization or disturbance to slope that poses a threat to surface water supply, surface water quality. The second function and purpose of the regional master plan is to start to establish the framework how those standards will be applied at the municipal level as municipalities do what they do, is review and approve site plan applications. So for those of you who have local planning experience, the distinction is you have one set of standards that are your permissible or conforming uses that apply to the zone, And then you have another set of standards that are typically referred to as your bulk standards, which are those standards that apply to use of a site, the use conforming to your designated zoning. So the same thing where here the land use capability map will define zones and uses in terms of whether development is appropriate or not inappropriate, not whether it's commercial or residential. And then the RMP standards or the smart growth resource protection and regional growth standards that would apply as a site specific standard. So there's two functions that the regional master plan accomplishes. And that's sort of the distinction. And with slope, it's complicated because one, we need a standard that can inform or can drive, help to drive the land use capability map, identify where constraints are, what are those significant, what is a significant constraint or a significant resource, where those are, and how you define a zone that captures that. And then secondly is, on a site level, how do you deal with that resource if you have it? Because it's everywhere. And we're going to have situations where there is going to be development on sites that do have slopes that are greater than 15%.
How are we finding these steep slope areas, Steve, to identify them in the map?
Here we're doing two things. One, we do have fairly, it's called a digital elevation model. It's a 3D model of the region, so we do know where generally and relatively coarsely those slope areas are. We're also recognizing the limitations of existing knowledge. The council some time ago approved going to the next step, which is using laser technology, what's called LIDAR, to do an overflight of the region so we could generate contour topographic maps at what's called Twofert contour intervals, which is the level at which you need to do site design work. So,
but when we release the plan, is there going to be a layer that shows
yes,
the steep slope areas?
We know where the slope is.
It's actually back in the corner of the 15% map. Yeah.
We know where, and we know it at 5% increments.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to add, you know, I think the tension the council's faced is, this space with is, it goes to Michael's point, is DEP's standards are site plan standards effectively. And so we're charged to do in Section 12 to merge them. We're charged to do a resource assessment, which, as Steve said, is to look at the resources, figure out what the most important slopes are for the region, and also implement DEP standards. So that reconciliation process results in two different approaches. One, as it relates to the land use capability map, and one is as it relates to site plan standards.
Now, are we going to have standards that are like in our steep slopes ordinance in Symphony, you know, it says if the slope is this steep, you can only, you know, disturb so much, a certain percentage of the property, whatever.
Yes.
Are we going to have something
yes,
like that?
Yes, and when will item number four in the policy paper starts to deal with that issue.
I just had a question related to what you said before, that at 10% it's too fuzzy, the information we have, and that's really why you're going for 15%, and that in the future we may be able to, quote unquote, harmonize those two. If you had the information that made it very clear where the 10% was, are you saying if you had that, you'd do 10% today, not 15?
No. We do know where 10% slope is based upon the information we have at the level of quality that we have it. It is 10 to 15% slope are very diffuse throughout the whole region. It occurs regularly. I mean, it includes a large percentage of the region. 10 to 15% slope is about that. I mean, there's a lot of it. And it makes it very hard to discern the area that represents a quote-unquote significant constraint on development potential, because not all slope greater than 10% represents a constraint.
Yeah, but isn't there some way that 10% could be identified as to whether or not it's proximate to water, for instance, that would then say whether or not it, that 10 or a certain type of soil or whatever it is,
that then it would be a significant constraint. And I hear what you're saying, yeah. Because if we're thinking about it in terms of a map, then we would have this big swath of color that goes, you know, maybe areas and shades, depending on whether it's 10 or 15. And I can see where it would be confusing to look at, but that shouldn't rule about whether or not, you know, we use 10% as the starting point or 15. Yeah.
We are developing a model, and we'll continue to develop a model that will not be done by the time the draft comes out, that looks at that issue. And we're capturing our ability to apply that model on a site-by-site level, and we will get to that under item four. So I'll cover that under item four, if I could.
I think the other way to ask the question is, you know, in creating a two-track construct for this, are you creating something that's comparable to the DEP standard to start off with? Because I think the concern is, I mean, the way you're presenting it, Steve, that the language of the Act actually talks about protecting and setting standards for steep slopes for reasons in addition to water quality protection, so unique landforms and other things. So my concern is that it doesn't get dropped out of the universe of what is going to be managed by this plan and by these sets of standards that are out there. And you're saying that you're just aggregating the ones that are clearly, when people think about the mountains or the highlands, you know, that's what you see. And then because of this diffuseness of the geography, you're capturing that through a site standard review. There's going to be a review standard, which is comparable to when someone comes in to develop on that property, what they're going to be required to do under the DEP rules and under this approach are going to be comparable requirements. Right?
Yes.
We're going to treat the land in the same way, subject to the same allowances, the same restrictions. It's just being organized differently in terms of the way the regulatory tool and the management policy expresses itself.
Yes.
Because I mean, because the way I heard it originally, it sounded to me like you were dropping out the 10 to 15%.
We are still capturing 10 to 15 through site standards, but not to inform the land use capability map.
Well, let's go on to the next policy.
I'd like to say out loud again, I've heard your explanation, I think I understand it, and my suggestion for us as a council would either be to say we're not going to be blind to the line, or we are, and what we're proposing here is just not acceptable. I mean, it's so tortured, it to me doesn't make sense. And if we're going to say we're not going to be blind to the line, I make sure it's in this document to say we're not being blind to the line, and why?
Well, let's see if the discussion of the other policies makes us fit together better or leaves us.
Sure, we can come back. Item number two, recognizing recommendation under item number one, is for purposes of defining the regional protection zone. That is the area of the highlands that is most environmentally sensitive and therefore most resource constrained and will have more significant constraints on future uses, is to utilize that 15% or greater standard and include those slope-constrained lands that are proximate to waterways. This is, again, planning standards for defining constrained lands for purposes of defining zones in the land use capability map.
This is what makes the whole thing kind of fuzzy.
Yeah,
it will. 10 to 20, now we're back to 15. Somehow we've got to find a way to make that clear in here without writing a tome about it. So somebody will hopefully do that.
Yes, we can provide greater clarity in the rationale. Item number three gets to now the site design standards. These are the standards that would apply to an application, regardless of the zone of the land use capability map that it falls within, on how to protect steep slopes and to ensure that development activities on steep slopes do not compromise the protection of the natural resource values of the region. Generally, it is a discouraged development activities and land uses in an area of steep slope. Require inclusion of a steep slope protection area within municipal zoning and land use ordinances. So, and again, this is dealing specifically to that area of steep slope greater than 15%. So 15% would be the standard that would, I define a steep slope, and that would inform decisions moving forward in terms of where to discourage activities.
When you say, I guess two things. One, just go back to two for 1 second. That is just a consistency thing. You use the language to locate in close proximity to sort of the water feature. Later on in the document, you talk about it being within a defined riparian area. And since that's a technical term that we're using to define a geography, you've got to carry that forward. So that people know that close proximity doesn't say anything.
Yes.
Near or adjacent.
It doesn't say anything because we don't have a definitive basis to do that on.
Well,
yet. We're still working on
that. But you do, later on in the document, you talk about it being within riparian
right. area. And then that gets to the site-specific design standards. So again, looking independently of preservation of work versus planning area, regionally, how does steep slope inform the land use capability map? And what we're looking at is areas greater than 15% that are near a waterway, and to what extent that could be included to define constraint lands and include in the regional protection zone. Now we have a situation where a site development application is going to come before a municipality that's conforming. What standard does that municipality hold that project to in terms of developing or designing that site? What we're doing is similar to what we've done before in a number of other things. We're establishing value classes. Not all slopes are created equal. Not all slopes represent the same resource value. And as such, not all slopes present the same constraint on land development.
Fair enough, Steve. And I understand that. And I'm quite comfortable with that. I think what I'm hearing here is a lack of specificity for the municipalities to make their own adjustments when they do get a site-specific situation.
Yes, and in many cases, that specificity will come pre-planned conformance. That is during the pre-conformance period, in which the guidelines for the guidelines and the specificity for applying this at a municipal level will be defined at that time, and will be subject to council review and approval.
In other words, the plan is not fully fleshed out at this point. No more than the discussion.
Correct.
We're making decisions based on just what is available.
Correct.
To meet the October deadline.
Well, we're making policy decisions, I think it's fair to say, and I think that's really what we can do at this point. But if you're talking about a subsequent process that we're all going to be involved in, public and council, then I think that's fair.
Yes.
And my point is that not that staff hasn't thought of it, but that this is a long process. And having this discussion at this time, this is the best we can do.
Yeah, and at the same time, it gives us guidance on, you know, on approach, the issue of 10 to 15 and whether 15 is appropriate and how do we deal with less than 15. I mean, this is the purpose of this process is to give you a summary recommendation on the basis of the plan and get your input so that we could either refine it to the best we can prior to release a draft, clarify language, and then provide the specificity during pre-conformance that allows it municipalities to know what their expectations or requirements are before we go to a conformance process.
I do think if maybe it's because the first policy is listed first, but if I were a municipality or a landowner and I had a site or a municipality that was entirely at slopes of 12%, I would look at this and say, well, I don't have to read this. This section doesn't apply to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's not what you mean.
Correct.
Their parts first, so somehow that has to be
up front. That I think item number one could afford clarification that 15% for purposes of defining steep slope in the land use capability map. However, during site plan or slopes greater than 10% will be reviewed
in
the development stage. Just to clarify that up front.
Not just reviewed, they will be regulated.
Well, they'll
be negotiated. Like, yeah. I'm not turning this into a political football.
No, I don't think that's a decision to be made, so let's talk about that a little bit.
Different site development standards depending upon the site
yeah.
that you may want to implement.
And then,
well, site by site basis.
Well, I would agree with you. If if I saw those standards, but I don't see even those standards.
Well, that's his four. Four really gets to the site standards.
Well, that's what you said, you ever get to that.
There are a variety of conditions of soil which in the site design or engineering context apply. That is the degree of slope, percent. The proximity of that slope to a water course. The susceptibility of that soil type to erosion losses. Not all soils erode at the same rate. When they're exposed, the type of cover that exists on a slope. There are many developed acres within the Highlands that are already altered and disturbed that are greater than 15%. A slope that is forested is much more stable than a slope that is not forested. And clearing a forest represents a greater threat to erosion or erosion risk. There is also something, and this is where we try to capture the DEP standards called land capability class, and DEP has decided to use land capability class as their standard for evaluating restrictions on development within slopes between 10 and 20%. So we've incorporated DEP standards into this, into our smart growth standards, smart design standards. The capability class looks at the characteristics of the soils, to what extent it's wet, to what extent it's stony, and those present varying levels of risk of erosion and ability to stabilize soils that are disturbed during construction. And then the depth of the soil, or if soils that are shallow, that sit on top of bedrock, are much greater risk of soil losses when disturbed than deep soils, generally speaking. So we've established a four-tier system of evaluating slope on an individual site that recognize that any slope greater than 20% or any slope greater than 10% that's within a riparian area or proximate to a waterway represents a severe slope constraint. And then there are certain standards, such as avoid disturbance on, that would apply to that severe slope constraint.
And that's the standard?
That is the framework under which the specifics would be developed. Yes, that's the standard.
Said, go to four and we'll find the standards. I'm reading the way you're reading it, Steve, that we're saying these are the things we'll look at, and the standards still aren't here.
Well, no, avoid is there. It's the first...
Well, then let me ask what avoid means. Does that mean not disturb?
Correct.
Okay, so this is, you're prohibited from changing if you are at 20% and above and 10 to 20 in a riparian area.
You would be prohibited from clearing that land. Now, there is developed land that will be within that standard, and we will be, how that is applied, we'll have to give...
Laughing because prohibit, I understand, but when you talk more, I understand less.
The difficulty is in situations where you have an existing developed piece of property on a slope that's greater than 20%, that maintenance of that use has to be permitted. I mean, we can't prevent or a maintenance of an existing use.
Steve, all of the caveats you've got are great, but you ought to be writing these down. I mean, we ought to be looking at this. That's what I'm really saying, is if you're going to tell us the standards are here, then they've got to be here.
And
when I read avoid, I think I read it the way you guys really mean it. That is, we're not quite sure what it is yet. But it's time to start being awfully sure, I think.
I would offer to you that there are many details in both intent and application that still have to be worked out and will not be included in the draft plan.
Well, you're telling me that we're just adopting the DEP, and you say the DEP doesn't have these details? I, I'm just repeating back to you what I've heard this morning. I'm not trying to pick on you. I'm trying to be specific.
That's okay.
Because I don't understand.
You can pick on me, too. It's
well, it may feel like I'm picking on you.
No, that's all right.
But I'm trying to be specific because I hear X, and then I hear not X, and I hear Y, well, close to Y.
I think the recognition is that there are much details to be fleshed out. And I don't want to give you the impression that that's not true. However, the standards that are being presented for informing how that the regional master plan takes shape are adequate to get us through a draft plan. So the policy guidance that the council is providing is that we are avoiding development activities on slopes that are greater than 20% or 10% when within a riparian area.
I understand those numbers. I still don't understand the void, except I think you don't want us to understand it because you're going to tell us what it means later.
Well, can we try it this way? Can we give them some prescriptive direction, which is I would recommend, Steve, that there are standards that you can shape, ones that are first off embedded in the Act. So you could tell the council now that the standard will be that development above, on slopes above 20% will be prohibited. I think the Act directs that, particularly within the preservation area, and I think that from all the rationales that you laid out, which I absolutely agree with, and I think are well-founded given the consequences of development on slopes, are justified. And then secondly, that, you know, on slopes above 15%, that existing uses shall only be maintained, and that, you know, additional clearing, additional impervious coverage shall not be allowed. And then when you get to the lower slopes, it's a little more difficult. But I don't think it's really that difficult to establish some more clarity of these standards at the point. And I agree with Michael that the avoid is a squishy word.
Yes.
So it doesn't give clarity. It doesn't give clarity for shaping standards that might be integrated or conform to the municipal ordinances. So
we can clarify that to read prohibit except to maintain existing uses.
Well, I think you have to break out new uses. I would establish existing uses as an exception to the standard. And you know, we've had this kind of runs through a lot of the conversation that I think the majority of people are anticipating how this plan and these rules will affect future development, new development of currently unaltered land. And then there's always the concern I know that's out there about how do we deal with existing uses, recognizing that there's a bad development in the past. So I think you break them out specifically. You deal with existing uses that are non-conforming to the standards as non-conforming uses. And you say, you know, those can be maintained, obviously. And if they're appropriate, you can make an argument for it. There may be some limited expansion allowed, like this has been allowed in some of the parts of the end. But I think you can't take a shot at being a little more clear with this and then backfill some of it in pre-conformance, which is this point I want to go back and clarify, that the articulating what the standards are that the municipalities are going to have to bring their ordinances into line with is going to happen during pre-conformance, not after the plan is adopted and out in some negotiation process.
Yes, and that's specific in item number 4.
I'm trying to make this easier and simple for local municipalities. When we get to the lower slopes, how much input will local municipalities have in making their decisions on zoning and development plans?
A lot in low slopes.
More at the lower slopes.
Yes, low and moderate slopes. Then it's just minimizing disturbance, but that allows a lot of flexibility.
For locals?
Yes.
Okay.
Are we going to have a definition of
minimize, yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Like
we should,
less than
whatever percentage. I mean,
I assume that was 10%
on that could define what percentage of a site would be disturbed.
And I would agree that is a specific standard that has to be available to a municipality.
Could it be available to this council, say, within the next 2 weeks?
Not
at least a recommendation, which would
This goes back to what I suggested earlier, that we're seeking specificity for use at the local level, and Steve acknowledged that that's not here yet, but it will be part of the second process that we're going through
Well, then maybe we should say that here. I agree that, you know, the specifics will be defined.
Well, I think we've all established that we don't think this is clearly written at this point. It's not communicating.
And it's stated under my item 5.
Rich, why don't you go through it, get through 5 through 9?
Chris, my last comment. This is not GPS.
I'm sorry?
We're not GPS in this document. We're not on the ground. We're not looking at site specifics. We're not looking at an application that comes before the town and making recommendations based on that particular parcel of land.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing broader policy decisions which can be defined subsequently. I hope that will be done.
Yeah.
I trust them.
You're giving policy direction, if you agree, that has to be done before
right. We go to municipal control. Where they are.
Because yeah. I will. Yes.
Well, Jack, two comments. I'll try to make quick. One is an overarching one. We've sort of come to a format for these things. I don't think the format's quite right yet. We're starting with staff recommendations, and you have buried back in here requirements. I'd start with requirements and get them up front. I mean, in this one, you know, I'm reading through here, and I have to get back to the back to make sure that I think I know that 15% is a choice for us. And that there are at least 5 paragraphs that you cited in the Act that talk about what we need to do for steep slopes. And I pull those up front and say, you know, we have to do X, Y, and Z with respect to steep slopes. And then you've got twice as much verbiage about stuff generally. And maybe you think it's necessary, but I don't when you're doing steep slopes. And if there's a reason it's necessary, God bless, you know, leave it in there. But steep slopes is very particular. There's some very particular requirements. And I sure would argue, based on history and tradition in the state of New Jersey, that a steep slope requirement would include at least at the time of our first final, but goodness, at the time of the draft, you know, X percent is at least our recommendation in terms of how much you can disturb in the, you know, whatever 10 to 15% area you're talking about, or 15 to 20, or whatever it is you want to choose. I mean, that's part of what steep slopes is in New Jersey. Every last ordinance that I've looked at, and it's not more than 15, but I probably have, you know, includes that.
I guess my point would be we're not adopting a master ordinance, we're adopting a master plan. I think that's the tension we have here. We need to develop an ordinance over time to give to municipalities, but the first step has to be a master plan that identifies the major policy issues and can give us additional direction so we can define the master ordinance.
I don't think that's right, Tom. In this preservation area, let me pick on the preservation area, and then you can tell me whether or not you want to comply to the line. Preservation area, we need to tell people in the 10 to 20% range, if that's what it is, how much you can disturb. I don't see why somebody ought to have to wait months on us.
No, I guess my point is that the details of a detailed municipal ordinance or require extensive time to give flesh and meat, and that's the time we may not have.
Steve, why don't you go through the rest of the policy?
Add one clarifying thing here. It's not so general as that. If there's an applicant that is within 100 feet of a stream, I'd say 21 or 12%, that's clearly different than someone who's 500 feet away from the stream. Or if one applicant has
God bless you, but
erodibility of soils and another does. I mean, they all have to be treated differently because of all these factors of proximity to the stream, erodibility of soils, etc.
Let's do it. I mean, we know that needs to be done. We may not get the right numbers in the first time, but, you know, let's get it in. I'll give you another one, and I hate to think what the answer to this might be, but in terms of specificity, do you have a horizontal run, that you're thinking about in terms of your vertical measurements?
No, we actually try to do that, and it can't be done based upon the information we have, but it's an important
consideration.
Well,
of course it can be done.
You can
pick 100 feet, you can pick 2 feet, you can pick a mile.
What the inclusion recommendation of standards that will subsequently come out is less than run is proximity to waterway and area, contiguous area to slope.
Well, there's at least one council member, to me, who thinks that that's wrong, that we need to put a run in.
We can accommodate a run.
And I'd like to agree with Michael on that.
I will offer a degree of advice that if we each of the resource constraining issues requires a tremendous level of deliberation and details in order to apply it at a municipal level, that we will spend an extraordinary amount of time both researching, developing, and presenting and deliberating those specifics, and that will come at the expense of time. So it's a balance between providing, as Tom indicated, the overarching guidance in terms of what is important and how council wants staff to proceed, recognizing that there's still a lot of details to be worked out, in order to get at least a plan on the street that provides an understanding of that big picture.
Right. And maybe we need some kind of an appendix that we would refer to and say, you know, this is being developed.
Well, I think, yeah, and the introduction and of the plan needs to say that, too.
And try to put a time frame on when it would be
Steve,
done.
Steve, please go through the rest of the policy just so we get more on the table.
So there are four value classes of slope. Severely slope constrained, both captures the greater than 10 when it's within a riparian area, and greater than 20% anywhere within the region. Moderately severe slope would look at between 10 and 20% that are not within a riparian area, whether or not they're forested, how large, what the erosion risk is, and what the proximity to that waterway is. A moderate slope would, again, looking at 10 to 20%, lower the degree of proximity, the degree of risk, and then finally a low slope constraint for which there is not a significant risk of erosion or is not within proximity to a waterway. And then the standards that would apply would be a prohibition on clearing or grading activities, with the exception of maintenance of existing use, or minimize those disturbance on those moderate and low slopes. And Liz, this gets to your issue, and using best management practices, as long as the slope is stabilized and standard soil erosion and sediment control treatment.
Assuming that the municipality knows their area.
Yes.
Better than we might.
Yes. Item number five. Item number five is pre-conformance strategies. Specifically, and this addresses many of the questions that are coming up, is to develop the technical guidelines and procedures for those steep slope protection standards that can be included in a municipal zoning and land use ordinance. So those are the specifics on how those protection strategies can be applied locally. What constitutes avoid or minimize? What is maintenance of existing use? Whether or not, what is proximity? Whether it's 100 feet, 300 feet? What is the linear run of a slope or the minimum contiguous area of a slope? Item number six, for inclusion and conformance strategies, is the requirement that a municipality that conforms to a regional master plan has to include slope protection provisions within their ordinances and municipal master plans. Not all towns do, and this would promote consistency of that requirement throughout the region. Item number seven, beyond adoption and conformance, the five-year resource protection and planning goals. Again, looking to the future is utilize advanced technology to more clearly define where slopes are and where slope risk constraints or where restrictions on development should be, using the LIDAR and developing two-foot contour interval maps for the entire region. Item number eight, coordination and consistency considerations. Consistency, ongoing coordination, consistency, and harmonization between the goals and objectives and strategies of the regional master plan and DEP permitting process. That is common throughout, that a consistent standard, where standards deviate, or consistent application of those standards at the DEP permitting process. coordinate with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, to provide guidance to the agricultural community on ways to minimize impacts to steep slopes and incorporate steep slope protection strategies as much as practical within farm management plans. Local participation considerations is educational program for municipal officials on how to apply steep slope protection guidelines that are in the regional master plan. This will require educational process. A lot of times it's going to be new or different. And again, what's common throughout a lot of these policy recommendations is education as a way of understanding and applying the goals and strategies of the regional master plan. That is the recommendation, staff recommendations on general policy actions with relating to steep slope protection.
Go ahead.
You put your hands up.
I have a couple suggestions. One, I understand the way this is laid out. We are following a certain format that you've set here, and I think it does work to a certain extent, but one thing that I think would help to clarify how later in the document, when you discuss standards, how those apply to the protection areas that are defined in all of these, is to have some sort of schematic. Have you thought about that? Like a picture?
Yes.
Sorry, I have a thought. Could you explain how that would work?
How a schematic would work?
Mm-hmm.
Would be if you take a cross section of a site, imagine just a picture, a side view with a stream, a slope that goes up from the stream at varying degrees, and that slope can be defined as that percentage of the land area that is between 15% and 20% or greater than 20%, and then a setback essentially from that stream, a point or a proximity. It might be 500 feet or 300 feet. We actually have more specifics, but we're still working on the details. But let's say you're within 500 feet of the stream, that you can color code the slope. A red would be avoid. A yellow would be minimize. And that schematically is essentially what you would do on a site plan review process. You would. And it's not unusual. You identify the 2-foot contour intervals. You identify what the degree or change of slope is, and then also look at the risk of erosion and proximity to the waterway, and defining where areas should be that you should avoid, and where areas are that you should minimize grading or clearing activities on. And that's generally, how the schematic would work. And a lot of these things they would be well. It would be beneficial if we had the opportunity and time to show you a lot of the information, but that would require a lot of staff investment time and a lot of council time to work through that. And we're more than willing to do that.
I can't talk right now, so Tim, why don't you go?
Jumping a little bit. I guess a couple of things. One, the value classes that you have before about moderately, severely strained. The range is from 10 to 20 as opposed to 10 to 15, which you use to inform and give a building map. So I just wonder about that consistency issue. And I thought I heard the discussion saying that 15 and above, but really once we start to get into problems,
yeah,
that ought to be reflected in that.
It actually, understood. We can clarify that.
10 to 15 and the low, right?
Yes.
Right. The breakpoint is 15%. Generally here, so that ought to carry through in all the classifications and stuff. And I don't want to create a lot of work, but it would be interesting to understand sort of how your capability classes mesh with the ones that are in the DEP rules of the preservation area. And if they're significantly comparable, that's great. Because I do think we ought to be striving to have consistent standards throughout the region. So we shouldn't reinvent things. If their stuff works based on the same resource constraints and considerations that you described.
But Tim, to that point, didn't we just go backwards then? Didn't we just explain that there were two different things we were doing here?
No, I understand that. I think that's why I asked the question about whether or not, in the end, they were comparable. So you're still you're still capturing the same activity. You're still controlling the development that might affect the steep slopes, and you're still managing it to make sure that those adverse impacts don't happen. But because these guys said we have the challenge of developing a plan that's going to express itself on a map, at least in part, you have to approach it a little bit differently than if you operate in the way the DEP does, which is clearly or strictly on a regulatory basis, applications come into them. And what I heard Steve saying was that even though they have different names and sort of different formats to them, the substance of it is the same. The dealing with the less than 50% on a site application basis, dealing with the above, at least in part, in the land use capability map and the regional protection areas, that in the end, if you strip away all that jargon, you get the same. I mean, ultimately, we're about what's going to happen on the land, right?
And it's going to. But an application comes forward.
Right, and we don't want to create holes that activities that ought to be regulated don't get regulated, or vice versa. So I hear that the same. I'm just saying, I think it's a good idea that where we can and where there's not a different goal, that the language and the tools ought to be the same. So the BP has land capability classes. We ought to make sure that they're the same. So we don't.
Just as to illustrate on the item number 4, the 20% was specifically used there so that they would be compatible with DEP rules. If we were to change that 20% to 15%, the standards, the policy, the implications of these policy recommendations would be more strict than currently what's in DEP's rules.
And then just two other quick comments. One is that in the pre-conformance, so I do think, I mean, Tom's point about this is a master plan, not a master ordinance. I think there's a balance point between the amount of detail.
Yes.
I think we need to be able to show people some indication of what the level of constraint, restriction, and allowances is going to be on land throughout the region. So I think you can go, there are steep slope ordinances out there. There's steep slope ordinances in the region, some of which are good, some of which are not so good. But there are what I would call general good practices. You know, you don't remove the vegetation. You don't try to build a house on the 20% part of the slope that we could articulate in this plan so that even though it's not a full ordinance and all that detail that's going to happen in our pre-conformance, we could give some greater indication as to where the plan intends to go in the release in October. And then lastly, under 6 in conformance, I would just, you got to put the state agencies into conformity. You know, DOT builds on the side of mountains all the time, and that they ought to be brought into this process as well. So,
and that's,
we put that in the, we put, I agree, we could add that there.
Okay.
Good question on the same point. This is being shared. Number 8, second bullet, particularly is consistency of coordination. The NRCS coordination. Who is in control? When we say we're going to coordinate the commission, Resource Conservation Service, and there's a disagreement, who has the authority to say what happens in the Highlands? Is it the Highlands Council that makes the final determination? The coordination and cooperation and mutuality are achieved is a decision. Would it be this agency?
In the independent state agencies that currently have jurisdiction under a variety of programs, their decision would control. In many instances, in the event of disagreement, that doesn't prevent the council from stating its position, the basis of that position that may be contrary to that. NRCS has its own independent authority. So we can work with NRCS, and NRCS has been great in looking towards common practices. They've been wonderful. So, and I think there will be a lot of agreement, than much more agreement than disagreement.
I'll put my speed back for a second. But in the event, who makes that final determination about what goes on in the Highlands? Is it the Highlands Council?
And it
Is it the DEP, of which we are in, but not of?
If it pertains to development activities and on a steep slope by a conforming municipality, then the council has, with greater degree of control.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a matter of jurisdiction. Some elements of this plan will, by the exemptions or various other aspects are built into the law, exempt activities from our jurisdiction. And to the extent that they can be captured by other entities that have jurisdiction, the coordination here is set up so that they can incorporate our concepts into their jurisdiction.
So if there are plans, projects, municipalities that are in the preservation area that are not exempted from the Act, and we have a soil standard in our regional master plan that's different from NRCS, you're saying they would have to comply with the Highlands Council here?
They don't have to comply. It's just the application won't get approved because it requires
approval.
But I mean his words. Right. They don't have to comply.
But that's what I mean.
I mean, it's not the agency has to comply. It's the
application has to comply. Thank you.
And then decides whether they're in compliance.
Again, it goes back to who has jurisdiction over it. There'll be some activities which we don't have jurisdiction over.
Jack, if I can, the way I would express it to the council is where we have jurisdiction based on the Highlands Act, we need to act as a council in the way that we deem appropriate. And that will play out. So Tom noted some examples where we have no jurisdiction because there's an express exemption, so we don't have it. We can just talk with other agencies who have the jurisdiction. For any time that we do, and we clearly do oversetting a plan, we need to set it and then talk with agencies about harmonizing in whatever respect, because if they have some jurisdiction and we have some, we ought to figure out what we can do about it, but we need to press our jurisdiction and use it where it's appropriate. And so in the development of the plan and all the ways we're talking about, these are places where you have jurisdiction, and so you ought to do what you think is best, and then we work from there.
I think it's an important question. I'm glad you're answering it accurately, because I understand what you're saying. I think it's an important question in the context of how we are perceived by the municipalities that we are essentially regulating. And will we then have the ability to be a final arbiter, for example, of some of those municipalities that find themselves at odds with issues? The answer is not necessarily.
Yeah. It's on our standards, yes. On where there are other overlapping jurisdictions, we can then use our influence to talk to those other agencies about why we made the choices we did. And to the extent that they have jurisdiction, it's a fact that we'll have to deal with that. That always happens with every agency. But again, I would start with doing what you think is best based on the jurisdiction that you have, because with that, you know you're carrying out your mission in the best way possible.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about agriculture in this regard. Then a farmer, because agriculture is exempted,
Well, it's not entirely exempted. It's exempted from the DEP standards in the preservation area.
So, a farmer can carry out agricultural practices in areas 20% and above. So, they can. And as far as these standards here, where we talk about coordinating with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the importance of that is because they're exempt and they can carry out activities no matter what the slope is, that we need to coordinate with them in order to have any input at all. Because we really won't have any say at all, even in recommending certain conservation practices and that kind of thing. It's really always going to be NRCS or USDA or some other agency that will prescribe what they can do within the Highlands, right? Yeah. Farming activities
are going to be exempt from those mandatory standards in the preservation area, and to the extent they're required to do management plans, NRCS has agreed that they will try to incorporate our standards to the best they can so that they can be implemented through those planning efforts.
And is silviculture included in that?
Yeah, I believe that it is. Yeah. Agriculture and silviculture.
You're talking about
exemption, again, exemption from DEP standards, but it's different. The council still has authority to have a master plan which addresses all uses, and then there's right the Farm Act. There are other not exemptions, but other things that we have to apply. but the exemptions for agriculture activities apply specifically to that.
Okay. I realize we have a whole paper on that. We're going to be discussing it later, but I was particularly concerned in terms of the slopes and how that applies in terms of the slopes. And I had a couple other specific suggestions, and you know, I will email in, and I think you're inviting emails to be sent in, but I did want to bring it up here because there were just things that I had, notes I had made that I will email, but then council members don't have the opportunity necessarily hearing it, so I wanted to just put it forward now. Under number four, I think it would be good when you're discussing under including the under the heading include the following steep slope thresholds for design standards to group the severe and moderate together with some sort of indicator that shows that the standard below apply for avoiding, but I'm going to suggest an alternative wording, disturbance of soils or vegetation, that applies to those two. In other words, maybe do them in red and then have that first standard below in red or something to make it very clear that what you can do in those first two is prescribed in the following standard. And then the same thing with the second two, to make it clear that the second standard that tells you what you can actually do in those moderate and low slopes is described in the second standard below that. And then just some word changes, I think under the established minimum design standards, the two bullets there, we should just say prohibit disturbance of soils or vegetation within a severe or moderately severe slope. And then on the second one, I would suggest saying avoid disturbance to a moderate or low slope using low-impact development best management practice standards could or may have negative impact on the water resources and natural resources, the language that we use throughout. So, and I think that gives us a little more protection and does away with some of the vagueness of these words, avoid and minimize.
Before you write that down in stone, Steve, I would like to suggest that I got the sense, looking at the avoid, which is this kind of a squishy word, was an attempt to suggest that we're not a prohibitive body in our entirety, that we're looking to be accommodating, where it's possible to be accommodating. Am I wrong about this? But also, we're not going to be heavy-handed about this.
I think we're going to be both.
we're going to be
left and a right hand.
It's not what we're going to be, but what we are trying to say here by using the squishy word, for example. And if that's the case, then I would like to change minimize disturbance to allow disturbance. If you were to be positive about this and make it seem that we are more accommodating than some of the language and some of the requirements may appear to be and might ultimately be, we could allow disturbance to a moderate or low slope using low impact development best management practice standards.
Yeah, and I'll repeat what Tracy said, providing it doesn't result in impairment or harm to the important resources of the house.
But instead of prohibit, instead of avoid, allow it within these descriptions.
Right. Providing, yeah.
Well, I think that's a good suggestion in terms of wordsmithing, but I think your first comment I would take it make objection to, because I think we do need to have very clear standards when you can't do something, and it's clear that we are not going to allow disturbance in slopes greater than 20% or greater than 10% if within a riparian area, or slopes that have these other characteristics, forests being susceptible to erosion, if it's between 10 and 20, and proximate to a riparian area. So we have to have these very clear standards, too, because there are, as we've been discussing, there's DEP regulation, and then there's what we want to see. And we have to have hard and fast standards, where everything can't be squishy.
No, I think you're agreeing.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. But on the first word, I don't think we did. I think the second one is a matter of wordsmithing on the first one.
I'll just give you a quick example, and it'll take up a lot of time, of the wordsmithing and the value. There was a story in the local newspaper about the immunocontraceptive pilot program going on in Morris County for white-tailed deer. And the headline suggested that the program was a failure because it had a 30% failure rate on the deer that were inoculated. The fact is, it had a 70% success rate.
I hear you on the second one. I'm just about the first one.
I'd like to be the kind of agency that is seen as allowing things to happen, but within certainly clearly proscribed areas and regulations.
Let me say one thing in terms of...
Who you are with that? I'm confused now about who agrees and just...
Well, I think where we are is we're, I mean, in general with this process, is we're individually making recommendations and suggestions which the staff is going to digest and reflect on and then ultimately give us a draft of a draft plan that will incorporate some but not others of the suggestions, and we'll all have opportunities to vote amendments at that time.
But John, if we don't make some interim decisions, we're going to get to October 26th and we're having the same arguments. So, like on that point,
The wording of the point?
I think that's a significant factor, whether we are, you know, how we're going to implement a standard. And, I mean, I come from marketing, so I know all about perception, but I'm not as concerned about that here as, you know, what are we agreeing a standard is going to be?
Well, I heard
we have a significant disagreement, there's a lack of consensus. We need to...
Especially not in disagreement.
On the second point, I think that is a matter of wordsmithing. On the first point, however, I think we do disagree.
Well, Judge, can we sum up where we think we are so you can...
What I heard was that for stringent standards, we're prohibit with exceptions, and for less stringent standards, we allow with provisions.
That's right.
I think that's what we're saying.
That's good.
Want to
vote on that?
In general.
Are there other comments, questions?
I've got an overarching one that relates to, I think, part of the colloquy between Tracy and Jack, and also what Elizabeth said a few minutes ago about talking to municipalities. And I'm a little bit lost, so I'd like some clarity. Steve, you talk about going out and talking to municipalities, and I think you talk often about a pre-conformance phase when we're doing that. So when you're saying that, I think what you're saying is we've adopted a final regional master plan, and I don't know, then I get lost, that you're going to change that master plan, you're going to make it squishy in terms of dealing with municipalities and counties. My concern is that's not what this legislation calls for us to do. The legislation calls for us to develop, it has the three nouns, the goals, the requirements, and provisions, I think they are in Section 10, 11, and 12 of the Regional Master Plan. It calls for us to get to the degree we want to, and I think the greater the degree, the more we do it, the better. We can consult with municipalities and counties prior to the adoption of that final plan. But frankly, the legislation makes it very clear that that's our choice. But once we've done that, the pre-conformance phase is a time to talk to them about how they're going to come into conformance with it. And I think you're not being faithful to the legislative mandate if you're saying, look, we're really going to work out with your municipalities in the preservation area what this stuff means to them and what we mean to ourselves. So when Tim was saying he thinks more specificity is a good idea, that's it's much more articulate than that, but I think it's more than a good idea. I think we're required to do that by legislation that spells out a whole series of specific things that need to be regional master plan.
And I agree with you, Michael, and it should be a negotiated process. That's cross acceptance. I think that's a key point, and I think that we've run up against this with every one of these issues. And what I heard and what Steve said earlier was we are going to define, minimize, and avoid during the pre-conformance strategies. I don't think that's right. We need to define these terms and exactly what we're going to be allowing and not allowing before we get to that pre-conformance stage. We have to do that now.
If I can offer a clarification of what pre-conformance is, there is the recognition that there's a lot of details that are going to have to be worked out, and that's going to require a lot of time and consideration by members of council. And we need those details before we go to the municipalities and can tell them clearly what this means and what they have to do to comply. It's the pre-conformance is a period of time that allows the council the ability to deliberate those specifics before we go to the municipality.
That's not what the legislation says. That may have been a great idea, but that's not what the state legislature is calling upon us to do with the regional master plan. And I can sit down with you and Tom after the meeting and walk through it, but that's not close.
Saying is we're fleshing out the details.
Has to be done for the regional master plan.
Then we won't make October.
But we'll never make it. And I see nothing but matter with recognizing the fact that there are very detailed bits that we are not going to be able to complete by the time that was designated for this. And so we want to make sure that what we do put out is valid and sustainable, upon public comment and all, but that recognize there are some pieces that we know are missing, and we will be following up and doing them and doing them right.
Are we really going to consider every particular case in this huge geographic area? I think that's an impossible task. I think the standards need to be strict, and I think that we're all here to see, this council's mission brought forward. But I think it's an impossible task for us to sit here and set strict standards for every possible scenario in this huge geographic area. So I think the standard needs to be set, and I think they're clear to me, but I would also like to know that we are not that stringent, that some municipality can't come up with some cases and not have the understanding or the possibility of being listened to.
Let me give you a specific though, because maybe we're agreeing, but I don't think we are. Steve has proposed, and it may change, it may have changed already today, or it may change by the end of the day, that we not specify how much disturbance between 10% and 15%. If we say that, if that's our regional master plan, that steep slopes are a good idea, and 10% to 15% is important, and minimize or allow whatever it is, I'm a municipality, and I say to you, I agree with that. Now, we're supposed to say whether or not they're in conformance with us. But awfully difficult to say they're not in conformance, I think. And if we've said, the most you can disturb is 50% of your 10% to 15% areas, just to fill out a number, pick whatever number you want. And then I think you're able to say whether or not ordinance is conform with that.
But you know what, no matter how specific we get, when a site plan comes before a municipal planning board, they say to their professional engineers, tell me if this is being dealt with in a manner to prevent erosion, to prevent any other kind of negative environmental impact. And every site will be different. And at some point in time you've got to rely on the professionals of the municipality to review the plans and make the appropriate recommendations to the planning boards.
They will only be recommendations to them. Planning boards are free to vary from those recommendations. And that's, I think, what you're talking about here, is that every site, I think that you're talking about, all of the 88 municipalities that we're going to be dealing with here have specific properties within them that need reflection. Need examination before we make a specific determination, even within whatever limits we prescribe here.
My understanding of pre-conformance is somewhat similar to Michael's, but I think what our goal here is to make a draft plan that is as specific as possible in terms of policy recommendations, recognizing that applying that to all the areas will be applied to is going to be he's going to raise site-specific situations, municipality-specific situations that we can't really anticipate now, but that as much as possible we anticipate within the plan. And then pre-conformance is sort of developing the process by which we will review the municipal plans to see if they conform with these guidelines. And some of them will be, some of the policies in the draft plan will be very clear and descriptive, and some of them are sort of by definition or maybe by necessity going to be somewhat more murky based on the limited amount of data we have or the need, and it's one of the challenges doing this whole thing at this point, is the need to overlay all the policies together. And we're, you know, we're by necessity talking about one by one, but at some point when we have a plan, we're going to have to look at them, how they fit together.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we continue as a council, and understandably so, mixing up a couple things here. And I'm not saying that during the pre-conformance we can't address certain things that are appropriate there, such as developing guidance documents, manuals, how-to advice. In the forestry later, we're going to talk about doing these forestry management programs during the pre-conformance, and putting together, you know, crunching, which is going to be, I think, I have been concerned that we have a lot on our plate during pre-conformance, but setting aside that concern, I do think there's certain things that are appropriate to do there. What I'm saying is what's not appropriate to do there is establishing the policies that will inform the standards. That's what we're supposed to be doing here now. And we can't put that off. And if we don't do it now, when are we going to do it? If we don't do it here, where are we going to do it? This is the time to do it.
That's a good statement. I think we all agree with that. I think. I mean, everybody.
But I think we keep, we say we agree with that, but we keep putting off. Well, down the road, we'll be discussing whether or not this, we're prohibiting or avoiding. We have to say now whether we're prohibiting or whether we're avoiding. And maybe not at this meeting, but I have concerns after our very first meeting. We said, okay, you know, what is this going to come back to the council? And then it seems as if it's going to come back to the council in a draft RMP. And then when are we really then going to tackle those issues? And I'm just concerned that we have to buckle down to looking at these very needy issues about policy now and sort out what are the ones that we must decide now in order to move on. And they're not the technical site-specific details. I agree with you. I don't even think we need a run to see where we're going with the steep slopes. It's not so much where the end product gets you. It's more what are the policies that we need to establish in order to move forward. And it's sometimes it's clear and sometimes it's not. I think in this steep slope one, it's more clear than it has been in some of the ones we've already dealt with.
Comment. I agree with everything you just said. That's been my concern, too, and I maybe haven't expressed it as well as you just did. But I see us deferring decisions, and I'm picturing it's going to be October 26th, and we're going to come in here with 47 objections to that document because we haven't resolved issues, so we need to work on it. But I also want to clarify what I said about flexibility and to address Liz's point. I'm going to clarify my own statement. We need to establish standards, and those need to be implemented. When that's what we're doing here, we're deciding the standards. Pre-conformance isn't about whether or not we're going to require a municipality to conform to those standards. It is a given. They must if they want to conform. Now, what you said you may not have meant to, it sounded as though you were suggesting it's flexible at pre-conformance. When it's flexible is when an application comes forward and we review it. And, of course, that's the point at which, how far down the road are we from this? We're going to get into those site-specific things, and that's where what Jack mentioned about a planning board, WAVE or whatever, that's at the point. But there should be, and this is back to my point about this is not cross-acceptance, that at the time we talk about what the town's municipality's master plan is going to be, there's not flexibility there. Now, if I just said something wrong, correct me. Because that reflects my understanding and certainly my philosophy, and I think I'm agreeing with Michael that we may have a different basis of understanding.
My suggestion is this, then, because I think there is something of a consensus among the council members, is that for this paper that staff rework it and bring this back to us either, you know, in one of the next two meetings, maybe in 2 weeks, but and then we address it again and
Well, I think we should review it. There seems to be only a handful of issues, really. Okay? Michael would like the run in here. I would like that as well. And that's something maybe we can decide right now. We have the issue of the avoid or prohibit. Okay? Which, whatever, however we're going to state that. And then, you know, the concern about what does minimize mean? Are we going to apply some ratio to that, depending upon the, you know, the characteristics of a site, whatever? Okay, that seems to be what all the discussion is about, pretty much. And if we could just decide on those, I thought that Jack's comment about combined with Tracy's that allow disturbance
up to
Put in some percentage, and then you had something else.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't.
And, well, Tom had a good assuring that there's no negative impact on water or something like that.
The idea, as you've expressed yourself many times, is to get municipalities to buy in and to want them.
Right.
It seemed to me, and Debbie, as a marketing person, you might agree with this, that if it's phrased more positively, using allow and then saying what you can't do or what the limits are, sounds much more accommodating, much more helpful, and would then serve that purpose better. So it's a philosophical point, but I think a key one in terms of how we are seeing it.
I think we agreed on that. Minimize allow disturbance up to a certain percentage.
I think at our meeting 2 weeks ago, the staff did a good job of hearing what was said here and coming back a week later with something that was pretty different, and I would entrust them. I've heard what we've said, been saying the last hour and a half, and do that with this as well. And I would also just say that I think, just to follow up on what Tracy said before, is that I hope everyone understands that, that anyone who has specific comments about these policies should be emailing them back to the staff, and to the extent, if you want to send them to the rest of us, you can. You don't have to, but that is important to do that.
But with respect, Mr. Chairman, I think that what Councilman Letts is seeking is the consensus of the council on these points, so that staff can have
the consensus. Can I suggest, Mr. Chairman? I agree. I think the staff is hearing this, but excuse me. Rather than having to rewrite the whole document, it might a one page. These were the major decision points that the council made. So whether or not the council's policy is to prohibit development above 20%. And that we can affirm that at the following workshop, because I shared Tracy and Debbie's concerns about just making sure that the guidance is clear as they craft the plan. And I think generally we are in agreement around the thrust of what the staff has proposed the plan look like, except around some very specific and discrete points. And that we could bullet point though. That would go no farther than that bullet points, no more than 10 letters. And we could confirm that or affirm it at the next meeting.
I would thank him for a suggestion that we don't redo the whole thing, Mr. Chairman. I was worried that, we have enough on our plate already and even more issues for next week. But, through even later in the day, I think we actually have a prohibit and allow language just from the colloquy. That may even be something after the break we can come back with. I would like us to clear as many issues as possible now so that we keep moving forward. And if we have ones that we can't do in that kind of way, then a brief kind of treatment, I think, would be preferable than going back to the beginning. And I think I would also thank you for your comment that if we get things out to folks, we can get comments during the week, and that helps us work them in as well.
Okay, to that point, what of these, once I finally figured it out about halfway through the last meeting, finally became clear to me what this format really meant. Only elements of this, the exact language of which, that are going to go into the regional master plan are...
Like in this example, would be the standards.
Out. It's not all of this.
No, it would
and
be like three
that
and four.
As we discuss. And it's the things that are actually the language of the regional master plan that we need to
focus
on. I think we need to vote on it. Interim, we clear them, to use your phrase. On the other hand, if we don't revise the whole document, Michael and others are going to rightfully say, I don't have a context to look at this in. That's the whole reason why we formatted this the way it is. So I'm suggesting, we don't need to vote or make a decision on this, suggesting we do revise the whole document, where we really focus on just somehow separate those things in the language of the plan, and we said maybe that will facilitate us moving forward.
Well, what you're proposing, I think, is consistent with something that actually Tim had raised before the meeting. He was asking, to your point, which language in here are the ones that are going to be operative. And for your reference, you'll note that like 1 and 2 typically deal with the map. 3 and 4 or the like generally deal with this, the site-specific standards, and as Debbie's correctly noting, that's where the bullets are things where we would get your specific comments, because that is something that's helpful and helpful to decide now. Debbie, we are updating these afterwards, and so our thought was to get these back to you in some way. We're not sure exactly how, but we obviously have to provide the context beyond some specifics. We're just not sure because we're balancing how to do that with the number of items, but we agree that purpose needs to get fulfilled somehow.
We don't need to approve the reference to the language of the act. I mean,
correct.
Right. We needed it to be us to work through this, but right. We do need to be wordsmithing and those
things. But we do want the reference to the act in the draft plan.
Correct. But it won't come directly from this. Right. It'll come in a different
and
format. You're right.
Well, maybe that would be helpful, then, as long as we're asking for clarity and change of this, is to give it back to us in the form you would think it would go in the final.
Well, we'd like to give you the draft. I mean,
yeah,
in the next several weeks, our hope was to take what you've been giving us in terms of this guidance and have it in the draft policy element so that you would see exactly how it's treated. And that way, we would get your comments. You know, and that's why I know, Mr. Chairman, you asked for some editorial folks to take a look at some of the wordsmithing, because, as you know, wordsmithing by committee is an extremely difficult thing to do, but to get that, but also it would give everyone else the principles, and then we could deal with any of the principles, as Debbie's suggesting, in a universal way, rather than doing it each time you see those requirements on a specific topic.
Okay. All right. Then if there's no objection, I'd like to move on to the forest resource areas. This is guidance for that. Address forest resource areas, and then have lunch, and then get moving.
Mr. Chairman, we could go to recharge next. I know Member Alstead was saying he was trying to get here and was hopeful that we could have ag and forest late enough for him. And if we could accommodate that, I think that would be helpful. Recharge would be okay?
That's fine.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on recharge, joining Steve is Lisa Voice, who's our principal environmental scientist.
So Lisa's going to give me a break on this one.
Good afternoon, everybody. I just want to say it's good to be back after what was a very tough summer, especially for me. But it's really just good to be back and working full-time again. We're going to be presenting our policy recommendations from the staff on prime groundwater recharge areas. And basically, what's most important about this, and I just want to start with this, is that groundwater recharge directly impacts both groundwater resources, surface water resources, the ability to sustain the water supply and the ecological resources of the region, which is obviously a critical thing and a critical goal of the Act, which is why we've done the effort we've made in this. And I'll get right down to brass tacks so we can get to lunch at some point.
Lisa, if I could ask you maybe to try to deal with Michael's request that we give just a really brief overview, not an overview as a history, but as a quick summary of the recommendation. Is it fair to say that our recommendations here are following the same structure as they were in some of our other resource assessments, which is that we will start with identifying the resource, identify which HUC-14s, since we use HUC-14s for our water basis analysis, have the most important value class of that resource in them,
yeah.
And then using that as a way of working into our creation of the three zones for the map?
Yes.
And
all three.
Okay, and also similar so the members see it, we will have specific site-specific standards that you'll see in, for example, number 3, number 4, number 5, 6, 7, I believe, that will go to outside of the map when we're applying these resource and the resource protections. We'll do it how we do it on a site-specific basis. Is that the general direction, or?
I'm not sure, given the conversation this morning, that we get down to what we would consider site-specific standards, but we do have policy recommendations and a general overview of the intent and the rationale for what we're planning on doing in more detail in later stages of this. So I think we're getting there, and I think we can point in the direction. But especially given the conversation this morning, I would hesitate to say we've developed the actual site-specific standards.
Okay. Well, that's my understanding, that the site-specific is what you'll see when you see our RMP standards members, when you look through the text.
To be determined.
Okay. Thank you for letting me interrupt. Okay, you can.
No problem. Okay. And again, to address some of Dante's comments, an overview of this, so you understand where we're coming from. We basically used the New Jersey Geological Survey groundwater recharge mapping method to rank groundwater recharge in the New Jersey Highlands on a relative basis only, because there are some issues with the method that we're trying to address. But on a relative basis, within each HUC 14 sub-watershed or drainage area, we looked for those areas that were the most productive in terms of groundwater recharge. And we did that by HUC 14, which is really just a smaller sub-watershed or drainage area. And again, we wanted to do that because it is so vital to protect recharge both for water quality and water quantity. So that was the purpose of this exercise. Getting to the staff policy recommendations, number one, again, the staff is recommending that the prime groundwater recharge areas be considered a critical natural area to be included in the land use capability map. The basis for that, again, is that the groundwater recharge is the process by which water infiltrates into the water table. It's the primary source of replenishment to groundwater. And in order to determine the resource value, we needed to find out where the most productive areas were, and that will allow us to protect both water quality and water quantity. And the reason for both water quality and water quantity is where most of the water goes in, that's usually where most of the pollution has the opportunity to go in as well. So even though the analysis was largely a quantitative one, we were very concerned about protecting the quality of the water as well in doing this. So both have to be considered. Okay. The staff recommends on number two that prime groundwater recharge areas are defined as including those lands within the HUC 14, again, just the sub-watershed, that provides 40% or more of groundwater recharge relative to the other land areas within that sub-watershed during drought conditions. And those are two very specific policy issues, really, using the 40% and also doing drought conditions. And the reasons include the fact that in order to deal with these issues, we need to understand them on a sub-watershed basis, because that's where the impacts are felt and that's where they can be managed. Also, using drought conditions is really the most stressed condition, which allows us to be protective and understand the resource and when the impacts are most likely to show up. I mean, we have problems with water supply during drought, we have problems with fish kills during drought, so that's the reason why these were chosen as the baseline, if you will, for the analysis, is those two issues.
A question, Mr. Chairman. Very clear why we reduced the drought. Where did the 40% come from? Was that a USGS suggestion, or that 40% figure?
We did a technical review for other people who had done similar work. In New Jersey, the only number really we could find was what was done for the Raritan Basin. They used a 30% number. There's very few other numbers out there for this. But basically what we looked at was the goals of the Act, and in order to do anti-degradation, we decided to use 40%. This was done on a quintile basis, every 20%. And the upper two were the ones we chose as prime because we went a little bit further than what was already established by the Raritan Basin folks. And also because there are other requirements for protection in the stormwater rules and other rules that the state has, so we felt we wanted to focus on the top 40 as a reasonable percentage, if you will. And again, it's based on our best judgment that we wanted to start there, understanding that the other 60, if you will, is already protected to some extent, but we wanted to be able to say these are the prime areas and that we felt these were most important in terms of quality and quantity for the resource for the region.
In terms of Tracy's question, just as general, I mean, I think that's the kind of information I think that should be in the rationale
for
all these things, is that when you read a policy and there's a number, the rationale should explain what the basis was for picking that number.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. How is the other 60? So 40% is 40% of the land area in the watershed that provides recharge. Is that the 40% number?
It's the land areas that provide 40% or more of the total recharge for that HUC 14.
So you're saying that if we protect that, the capacity of that land to do that, to fulfill that function, and that'll preserve both quantity and quality. How are the other 60% addressed or dealt with? You said there are the other 60%.
In terms of not allowing for net loss of recharge under the stormwater rules?
Yeah.
So basically this would be an added level of protection for that top 40%. Okay. Moving on to policy recommendation number 3. The following standards are recommended for inclusion in the RMP in the regional protection or the most protective zone that we're talking about within the regional master plan. Following along the first bullet, we're going to include prime water recharge areas to the maximum extent practical, given other considerations for the land use capability map. If I could take a minute just to explain what maximum extent practical is for us. Basically, it means that the results of this resource assessment, just for groundwater recharge, have to be considered along with other resource assessments that we talked about and resource protection means. And then we have to look at the requirements of the Act in an integrated manner. We have different resources that require different levels of protection in different areas. We also have growth and protection things in the Act we have to balance. So when we say things like maximum extent practical, it's basically that balancing act and how we're going to deal with that as we go forward to get rid of some of the squishiness, if you will.
I have a question on that. I wanted to hear from Tom. Is it because of the language in the Act that maximum extent practical is the best we can do? I mean, why can't we say maximum extent possible?
I think this goes to the building of the land use capability map, and to the extent there will be a process to build that, that will need to merge the various layers. That's modifying how we build the map, not how specific applicants are treated by the issue.
What would change if that phrase was eliminated? If it just said include groundwater recharge areas.
Well, I think there. What we're saying is that there's going to be some discretion in terms of how the staff built the land use capability map to integrate different layers, and we just want to make that known to the council.
Which weight you're giving to each of these factors, is that what you mean?
Maybe Steve can address it more specifically.
Yeah, right. And overall, though, that's exactly what Deb's saying is exactly right. I would call this a placeholder for you before October, because you will see exactly how this is factored in with all of the other things when you decide on the integration of the map before October.
But that phrase?
That phrase will not be in the plan. This just says to you that when we're doing looking at the factors that will create the integrated map, this ought to be one, and this ought to be something which is we expect for the most. Probability is going to go into the protection zones, because if it's a prime area, it's likely to be in the most protective zone. But we'll show you exactly how that works. We just want to make sure you agree if it's a very high quality recharge area, as a general matter, that's going to go into the highest protection zone when we do our three overlay zones.
How is that a policy decision? Are we going to look at that, or I mean, how?
Which thing? We want you to say, yes, we agree. Generally, those are the most important, so generally you should be trying to put them in there. And then we're going to show you exactly what we do with any caveats or provisions when you look at the integrated map, and we explain exactly how we did it.
And then we'll have opportunity to have input into the refinement of that?
Oh, of course. That's the land use capabilities map review that's scheduled for either the 28th, I think, or whatever the right date is. But so this is just a placeholder to say you agree that that overall direction is. Debbie says it's going to be a factor. We'll tell you exactly when in a couple of weeks.
Where is that you're looking at, Tracy?
That was the first bullet on 3, where it says include in the most.
Don't use that language. I mean, Tom, that language has legal weight to in terms of how things. Your explanation again was much more direct than anything here.
Yeah, we can just take that language out. I mean, and to say given other considerations, of course.
Like the quote Frankenstein, we'd say, recharge area is good, fire bad. So, I mean, that's all we want you to do. It's good. This is the good stuff, and we'll give you the specifics.
Right, but do we really need that language? I think
this language is only...
We put it now. I mean, I'm just saying.
This language will appear in the regional
no.
master plan?
No. Okay. This is again, anything dealing with the creation of the zones... is a mapping thing which you're just looking at to say yes, go ahead and keep putting together that map.
We've got to do something. Can you use a different font?
Yeah, we'll work on something, obviously.
We'll work on something.
Yeah.
Dante,
yeah.
Sort of an overarching question.
Yes.
I guess it has to be expressed in these contexts, but what you're saying is a recharge area in a Huck zone that is at this level is not enough in and of itself to be protected, to be defined by us with some set of standards by itself.
Yeah, it may not be. So because we can't give you the definitive answer, that's why we're saying stay tuned shortly. But, I mean, you would expect, and that's why we think it's pretty no-brainer that you say it's most likely to be, but it may not be in every case.
I'm just walking through the logic, and I guess I want to say out loud for myself, sort of sub silentio, you're asking us to approve that as a notion, that we're going to do some adding of values together and then say something is X. First, everybody ought to understand that, because then 40% may or may not be the right view. Maybe it should be a different one. Everybody just should understand that. But I guess I want to say out loud, I'm sort of troubled by that, at least, again, with respect to this one, and we dealt with it in something else 2 weeks ago, that, you know, I might say to you, it sure seems to me, and I'd sure like, you know, the staff to contemplate it maybe has, that this is of significant, such a significant piece of what we're doing, that we could look at recharge zones by themselves and not need to be asking, you know, is it forested or not forested, or is it, you know, the cultural artifacts or whatever else it is that's going to boost it to a different level. And that feels like the right way to go to me, that you know, focus on these by themselves. So I at least want to say out loud to you that personally, I'm not comfortable. I could be at the end of the day, but I'm not comfortable today saying this, you know, additive process of scoring areas I think is appropriate for recharge consideration.
Well, what I could say, if it's okay, what I would say is we'll report back to you, because I think what we're saying is, you know, we're expecting these to be in there, and on all of these places where we have had this language, we'll figure out how to treat this. We're really saying, you know, this is generally where it's going, and we're going to tell you how we work it out when we give you the recommendation on integration, and that's when you'll see it. I think this is part of the difficulty of going through each of these things individually and then integrating them, but it's...
But Michael's point, Doug, I think more broadly is, again, it's the construct of these memos that there's a piece of this that informs the map. But later on, you are saying that there should be groundwater recharge protection areas. So a zone that is specific to that piece of land that has the recharge that would be integrated into the zoning ordinances. So just as an overlook. So I thought that's what you're saying, Michael, that it's important enough to deal with by itself. It ought to have a mechanism to deal with it.
Oh, I see.
And so the staff is saying that. They're saying, use that consideration, protect those areas to build the map, which guides one set of policies, and then recognize we're going to need a tool, in essence, to inform local land use decisions on how to treat those areas again. Mm-hmm. So it is, both those pieces are in there. But it's a good point about, you know, understanding how the maps can be built and what the weighting is.
Michael, if I can give you a little comfort, there is a real recognition that this is a very critical issue in terms of both sustainable water supply and groundwater quality. I don't think any of us is unaware of that on a very large level, and it's been, you know, brought up many, many times. So,
yeah, I didn't mean to apply.
Yeah, no, I'm just, you know, so everybody understands that it's definitely recognized by the staff that this is a very critical factor in terms of both water quality and quantity.
Lisa, then, just to clarify, and maybe you said it earlier when I was reading a piece of this, but how did you decide that should not stand on its own as a resource that would preclude development?
I think when we get further into this, when we go through, we've just gotten started on the regional protection zone, and obviously there is an emphasis on making sure these things are protected. When we go through and get to what we call specially planned areas, now we have the LY at the end of that word, in all the documents, there may be reasons why we have to be able to adjust that. And I get into it, but I'll just mention it very briefly now. When we get into a TDR area, redevelopment area, we may have to use engineering solutions and allow some loss of that particular recharge zone, and we may be able to mitigate it elsewhere. or we may be able to engineer a solution like a channel or an injection well or whatever it is to get to another issue in this, which is a no net loss issue. Much like wetlands, if you have to, you know, wetlands are allowed to be fudged with here, you need to replace them in the same watershed or as close as you can, and that's an issue that we're trying to deal with here as well. There may be ways to deal with the need to allow growth in areas where it may be otherwise appropriate to get us to a point where we have no net loss of groundwater recharge volume through engineering or best management practices, and also we have no degradation of water quality that's being recharged through different means. I guess my point is, you know, if we've got a brownfield, maybe we want to be able to redevelop that if we can, but that may mean that we lose recharge right there, and that may be because recharge usually ends up being in flatter areas, not on the side of a hill, that may be where there's good recharge, but we want to be able to redevelop it as well and have that flexibility, which I think Jack may like, actually. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think we're back to the same fundamental problem that we have here. I think we should be stating you don't touch the prime groundwater recharge areas. Then, in a brownfield area that's being redeveloped, you may do something. We have to have our standards out there as the banner and not try to define the standard or equivocate that standard by what you might do in a very small and a minority amount of the time. So I think that, again, I think it'd be a lot better here if we just say we're recognizing the prime groundwater recharge areas as being critical, and we are going to include them in the map, and then we say what you can and cannot do there. And one of the things you cannot do is interfere with the recharge in those areas. And we should just lay it out, and not, rather than saying, in, as we have here, a sort of equivocating through the phrase that's added under bullet number one, you know, cross that out after areas, cross everything out. And then the second bullet, rather than talking about what you know, might be able to do in order to define what we're going to do in the first place, just muddies the water.
I think the second bullet, number three,
yeah, that's what that attempts to do.
Is a policy. I mean, we could argue about whether the first word should be discourage or prohibit,
right.
But that's a pretty clear statement that in the regional protection zone, you don't mess with prime groundwater recharge areas unless the final phrase in there.
Well, I would agree with you if you use the word prohibit.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Going forward, we got the message from the first one that we'll use, like, prohibit disturbance under whatever conditions, allow disturbance with these provisos. So, I mean, if you'll sort of suspend that sort of comment for the moment, I mean, if that the substance of what's in there works, we obviously can get that phraseology in there.
And that's just the kind of input that we're looking for in terms of, you know, how you want to word this and how prescriptive you want to be, and I think it's valuable to go through this. But I do agree that this sort of lays out a tiered approach to these things that protects it and understands that it's very worthy of protection and allows the wiggle room where we have other conflicting goals in the Act, and that's maybe the only place for this one that we go there.
But the wiggle room will only be determined at the time that a site plan is being reviewed, really, an awful lot of it. You know, if something says, okay, it's a significant recharge area and you can't do anything there while a site plan comes up or it's going to in some way impact it. It's something that will have to be reviewed for.
And even then, we're requiring no net loss and no degradation of quality,
right,
even in those circumstances, just using different means to get there.
So can you
sure.
Explain the difference between the proposed policy and the regional protection zone versus the regional investigation zone?
Surely. Okay. Going to the second bullet under number three, whether we use discourage or prohibit, we can do either one. We're looking to have a control on any land uses that could impact recharge, either quality or quantity, within these prime groundwater recharge areas. Again, except within a specially planned area, which would be like TBR, and only upon a demonstration that any relief we give will not impair or reduce groundwater recharge quality, rates, or volumes. And that would be the only circumstances. They would have to be able to prove to us that they would not impact those things if we gave them any relief at all in this zone, the regional protection zone, which is the most protective.
Can I ask just on your, first of all, I think it would be helpful to put the no event loss of quality and quantity as a policy and not subsume it under a development standard. But I guess my second question is, do you envision that that there would be plans that would be done, you know, at some level that would lay out how that would happen? Rather, I mean, you're kind of focused on site specific again, as opposed to the HUP 14 basis, right? In conformance, we want the towns to protect these recharge areas. We're going to want them to identify them, right? And then in those areas where there is going to be some development allowed, we're going to want them to explain or demonstrate how they're going to protect those values on a net basis. Mm-hmm. And that's a planning exercise, at least at one level. You can't do it on site. So I don't see that second part.
We'll get to it later. It is included in terms of some of the later policy issues in terms of requiring them to be involved in regional stormwater or wetlands mitigation management areas. There's a recognition, and again, when we talk about some of the engineering and some of the best management practices for this, some of these things have to happen on a site-specific basis. Some of them have to happen on a regional basis, depending on the level of impact. I could give you a list of artificial recharge methods, but we won't go there right now. Some of those, I mean, as you may be familiar with, if you know about how they do this in the state, Wildwood has injection wells that keep the water going. Long Island, they put in, you know, recharge designed all along the LIE to make sure that aquifer was recharged. There are examples, local examples, of how they've done this on both a site-specific basis, which was very clear, and also how there's been recognition going back to like 1920, 1930, that there are regional needs to maintain the aquifers and the water quality that have been implemented successfully over the last pretty much 70 or 80 years. So we know those. We just, and we'll get to it later, Tim, when we talk about coordination and consistency issues. It is in here. Okay. Bullet number three under number three. When we get to development that might infringe on a map on a map prime groundwater recharge area, again within a specially planned area, they need to use BMPs, compensation or mitigation. Basically, there's no way out. They have to give us no net loss. They have to give us no degradation in these areas. And there's maybe different ways to do that, but in these areas they have to do it. There's no way out of it.
Good question. I just wanted to interject that, you know, there are three verbs that relate to surface and waters in the regional master plan. The goals of the regional master plan with respect to the planning area shall be to protect, restore, and enhance. And restore, I'm not sure we've addressed restore when we talked about no further degradation. And I'd at least like the staff either to come back and say, we have thought about it, and here's how we thought about it, here's how it's reflected in the plan, or change some of this, like, you know, you could do some development and that's improved by 10%, the recharge. I don't know how the heck you do that, but I'm just asking you to remember that restore is part of our charge.
Okay.
And I said planning area, but I'm pretty sure it applies to the preservation area as well.
I was
going
to call you
on it. Well, I knew you were.
I was just going to say, I don't see how two and three are really different, bullet number two and bullet number three, and that really what you're saying, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're saying we're not supposed to be disturbing those areas unless you can show that you're not going to hurt them. But then you say, and if you do, the third bullet is really a qualifier to that. Say if you do disturb it, then you have to use low impact development. So I would suggest combining two and three and making it one bullet, and it just explain that when it is disturbed, you have to use these low impact and best management practices.
Just again for explanation, Tracy, what happens, and this is, it follows along the lines. I don't think we actually did it that way on purpose, but in reviewing it, when in the stormwater rules, you have to demonstrate that you maintain pre-development rates of discharge, which is really very similar to bullet number two here. We're basically saying, you know, you have to demonstrate to us that you're not impairing quality or quantity. And then, again, in the stormwater rules, then the next step is you have to prove to us that you can maintain this by using X, Y, and Z. So it's very similar to that structure. Prove to me, calculate for me, prove to me that you're not going to screw it up, and then tell me how you're not going to screw it up. So it's a determination of the resource and the volume and the quality that's going in now, and then you have to prove to us that you know how you're going to make sure it's protected.
I hear you. It sounds more like a guideline to me. It doesn't really sound like a standard, but, you know,
It doesn't say prohibit, it doesn't say required. But I agree from an editorial point of view that I think having this as a separate bullet enhances clarification. Rather than putting them both together, it becomes too voluminous to really filter through, it seems to me. That's just my point of view.
I think it's a little confused by having the same phrase in bolding in both, but the second one's referring to everything except the specially planned areas. The third one's referring to the specially planned areas.
I'm not sure that's
not
the
true.
Case.
You're saying where development is allowed, it does infringe within a specially planned area. The second one says except within a specially planned area.
Oh, that isn't how I read it, but I think you're right. Now I have concerns.
We're
going to
have to look at that.
Okay.
I thought then we were sort of undoing what we say in bullet number one and bullet number two.
Okay.
Are we, Lisa?
You're going to have to look at it. I don't think that was the intent.
No, the intent is to limit encroachment within a prime groundwater recharge area to those that are specifically identified as a specially planned area. And then where that activity demonstrates that there will be no harm, that they must then provide the compensation to provide for no net loss or net increase in recharge.
You can rework that.
Yes.
Just make a general comment about guiding principles. Let's not forget that this stuff that we're wordsmithing someday, some judge is going to get it right.
Yeah.
And it's important that we take the time to get it right, because then the exact word we have to know is going to be right.
There are lots of debates about commas and subjunctive clauses. Is there any question?
Lisa,
we won't use either.
The second bullet, how does that differ from the first bullet under six, to go back to application?
Three number two and six number one?
Yeah, I mean, and maybe the whole three and six. I mean, we're going to be talking about standards. Can we talk about them in just one place?
Well, I think, aren't you talking about the zones here, the way the formatting is? You're talking about the zones and what the standard, what can happen in those zones, and then that next section talks about the standards that apply in the zones. That's how all of these papers are set up.
Mm-hmm. It's site-specific or not. The later one, the number six is for site-specific application, and three is for applying it by, you know, well, the overall point
one
is...
One says discourage, one says restrict.
Oh, I see. Well, we're going to work on the verb part of it, but you see the difference between there's a significance for when the resource is used in a zone, whereas where it's done on the matter of when an application is reviewed. Right, six is the latter.
Maybe we should try to just have one set of standards, whether you do it by the individual zones or the law, I don't know. I think we also make it difficult for us to be consistent as we make amendments to this thing.
Well, part of it, remember, is that once we establish what our overlay district zones are, we need to say to towns what has to happen in those, what the standards are for those. And those aren't always the same as the reviews that are done on a review-specific basis. So we'll try. I think the construct is helpful, but we might have to think of how to explain it so it's clear.
You know, if we're finding some of this a little confusing, when we've been dealing with this for quite a while now, I think the public might find it even more confusing.
Well, they're going to have the benefit of being able to read through the regional master plan, which can have more of the context. Again, we started with more of the context up front. You guys said get right to the recommendation, so maybe we've tilted a little bit too far backwards, but there will be more of a context, and I think it's any regional master plan is going to have a lot of subtleties the first time folks go through it, and probably more for you now because you have to develop.
Because I don't want the municipality saying, I don't understand this.
Right, well, that's clearly right.
It has got to be a readable document.
Agreed.
Not necessarily.
Okay. We're ready to move on to policy recommendation number four. Under number four, the staff is recommending the following standards be incorporated into the regional conservation zone, which is agricultural, rural, and suburban areas under the land use capability map. The first bullet in under number four is including the prime groundwater recharge areas.
So that would be put,
given
put those,
other
put those areas
considerations.
In, yeah, so we put those areas into the conservation zone.
Good
would be the approach we would take while we're integrating. We'd explain to you exactly how and why we did that.
Right. And the second bullet under the regional conservation zone is to allow for adjustments and revisions to prime groundwater recharge areas. Examples would be potentially an increase in impervious cover or potentially a loss of forest land within a specially planned area, which we didn't bold in this one. Again, with demonstration that there's no net loss in volume and no degradation of groundwater quality in groundwater recharge. We're repeating the fact that they have to both demonstrate it and for both water quality and water quantity in these areas, which are, this is the second tier in terms of protection. So it's still there, and basically the same standard applies that they need to prove to us that they're not going to.
Is it basically the same standard or the same standard between the protection zone and the conservation zone?
Having looked at and heard your comments on number three, where we break out the way we want them to show us and demonstrate, and then that there's BMPs. I'm noting that the BMPs part is not here, so we probably need to look at that. So it is a little bit different how it's written here, but what I'm hearing is we may not want it to be different.
Mr. Chairman,
well,
I think
all I was saying, just to be clear, is if it's the same policy, the wording ought to be identical.
I was going to say something similar to that. I think it is sort of like you've combined bullet two and three in this second bullet under this section here. So you've done what I was talking about earlier. But I have a concern because now it seems as if we're changing it somewhat. And I want to know if it really is exactly the same. Because under one, which is number three, I'm sorry, where you're discussing the regional protection zone, that's the area that's the most pristine. Those are the areas we don't want to be messing up. Mm-hmm. And I was understanding by these bullets that our policy considerations here are to consider that when you have a specially planned area, an area that is a redevelopment area, that you may allow some changes within that prime recharge area if you're not going to be impairing the resource. And that just gives some latitude to these redevelopment areas. But then you have almost the same language, but then introduce some concepts which are much more than that, which is saying you can increase impervious cover and lose forest and other natural land cover, and as long as you show that you're not going to be hurting the resource. So I'm wondering, first of all, what is the difference between the protection and the conservation here? Is it exactly the same standard? And if it isn't, we should be breaking it out very specifically, because I think that we need to be protective of this resource in both the protection and the conservation zone, and we should understand exactly what we're doing here as a policy if we are infringing in either one of these zones on the recharge area.
Thank you. I don't see anything different other than there's a whole lot more words in this one.
I think the demonstration is intended to be the same. There may be some difference in terms of how we get there, but I agree. I mean, I think we need to go back and look at this language and see how we can improve upon it, because the demonstration, and from my understanding of it, is that it's the same demonstration of no net loss and no change in groundwater quality. So we need to go back and look at the language.
Okay. I think you've heard the point. So.
Yeah. Tracy, which one do you like better?
I don't really like the way they're written.
Okay. I sort of figured that one out. Okay, we'll go back and work on it. Okay.
Lisa, can I just ask a question? So there's a policy recommendation here that we ought to protect these areas from development, except that we are considering allowing the creation of these specially planned areas that may infringe upon the recharge areas. And I don't hear in here any criteria to guide us in when that's appropriate. You're saying if you make the decision it's appropriate, then here's the mitigation measures to follow on. So I guess one question would be, you know, is there some thoughts the staff has about when that's appropriate, when it's not appropriate? We acknowledge, and we've had this discussion, that specially planned areas are redevelopment areas around currently existing, you know, land uses, whether that's, you know, IC cover or brownfields. But, you know, there is also some latitude to increase those. So that's not going to be appropriate in all areas. So we may make a decision that it butts up against an especially critical recharge area, and that's not the right place to do that. And I think that kind of policy decision ought to be here and clear. The council will designate specially planned areas that infringe upon recharge areas under these circumstances. So you're saying you're not giving us any thoughts on the threshold question, which is when should you create those areas? And I don't think it should be catch as catch can. I don't think it's, you know, purely in reaction to, because you have to meet the standard of protecting that 40% that you're set as the ultimate goal.
USDA prime recharge area? I'm making a joke. I'm just trying to understand, based on a site-specific review, you feel that we need a threshold that would basically preclude impact in a specially planned area?
Break this policy down. You're saying that there's a given amount of geography within each huck that needs to be protected in order to protect the groundwater. Okay? And then you're saying, now, there may be instances in which you're going to sacrifice some of that recharge area in order to meet other goals. And those goals are embedded in specially planned areas, right? It might be redevelopment, accommodating TDR development, whatever it might be. All I'm saying is that we don't seem to be wrestling with the question or addressing the question of when that's appropriate to do that. And that's the guidance that ought to be here. Because there are places where we don't want to do
it. And we will advance that in the concept of when the council would approve specially planned areas. All we're doing is a placeholder here. You see what I mean? But certainly it is our intent to establish a process for approval of specially planned areas.
And by definition, specially planned areas include those areas that are previously disturbed and don't represent the critical resource. So
we also talked about the fact that in the context of that definition, we're not going to draw a footprint boundary that only goes around parking lots or buildings. It may be broader.
Yes.
Right? So it may encompass these sensitive resources. And we ought to talk about when it's appropriate to move those resources from their natural state into redevelopment.
But the concept is that the council would be approving these areas specifically.
Well, that's a process thing. I'm just saying, right. You know, and I don't believe in unbounded discretion for anybody, whether it's, you know, us or DEP or anybody else. So we ought to articulate that policy decision in this plan.
Where would that fit in? Because where
did
we define special? It's in the
glossary. So obviously it's coming, though. Yeah. The section dealing
with that is
coming. So.
Yeah,
but then we haven't. But we haven't discussed it.
Let me take that a little further, because I have another concern that will sound like an old one. But it seems to me we ought to articulate in these documents not only the process, but policies / standards that will move us to a change. And the reason, which is what you've said, but there's another reason behind all of this, and that is we're allowed to amend the regional master plan. Municipalities have to conform to the regional master plan. An amendment, I sort of hear the staff talking about ongoing amendments through site standards and so on and so forth. It's not clear to me at all that a court is going to agree with us. In other words, municipality sues us and says, I conformed with the regional master plan. I agreed to everything in it because I've said I agree to everything in it as of January 1st, 2007. And until we amend it, they may have a great argument, officially amended. And I don't think, as a practical matter, we're going to get away with amending it every 2 months formally. And I'm not sure we'll get away with amending it informally at all. So the way to do that, sort of get to the same effect, but fit within the ambit of the legislation, is to spell out this stuff that says, not we're going to make these changes going forward, but these changes need to they won't be changes because we're going to reflect up front, here are the considerations, and you are out if you are within this abstract definition, and you're in if you're not out, or however you want to do it. But if we're silent on that question and say we're going to, you know, do it a little bit later on, I'm very worried that we may be caught between a rock and a hard place. And we may get one shot at it, in July of 2007 we can amend and have it work. But I don't think we can do it very frequently.
If, Michael, no towns will be buy into this right away, they're not going to January of next year sign on to this. So we said is up front that there are things that we need to do before any town enters into conformance with it.
Well, the ones in the preservation area are required to conform within 18 hours.
One way to deal with it is we set the schedule, and I think part of this, I think, will be, because I think your point is right, that we have to make sure it's clear what's in the plan, that it's properly adopted. And at a minimum, that when we open it up to conformance, whether it be mandatory conformance or voluntary for folks who want to opt in, they need to know what the plan is, and that at least has to constitute what's adopted in December. And if any of the standards that are referenced in that are developed, they have to be in existence and incorporated into the plan in whatever way that's appropriate before the towns set off on their journey through conformance, because you're right, we need to make sure it's clear and justifiable.
The tension with that is that the plan, whatever standards we have to be defensible. So it's both things. It has to be as specific as possible, but we have to have an explanation of how we pick the numbers we pick and why, and be comfortable.
If I can move on, I think I can answer some of Tim's question. If we move on to policy recommendation number 5, again, for the regional development zone, which is redevelopment areas, TDR, and other areas that are determined that they can support development for all the reasons that we're going to talk about in the plan, we're recommending, and again, Tim, this to me is the basis of where we have to get clearer in the language about this, that any development activity, even in TDR areas, demonstrates no net loss of quantity or no degradation to groundwater quality. So even in the redevelopment zone, we're saying that as a basis, and that may be the baseline. That is the baseline for all three zones, if you will. I guess my point would be that in requiring no net loss and no degradation in the different areas, where in the conservation zone it may be land preservation and keeping it in its entirely natural state, in a TDR zone we may have to go to artificial recharge, vegetated buffers, requiring more intensive engineering rather than land preservation options, depending on what zone you're in. And I think that's the part we need to be clear about. There's a way to protect recharge, probably better than most things, through a wide variety of means, and it gives us the flexibility in these areas because, I mean, every square inch of land is recharge potential. What we've tried to do is break out those that are most productive, and then what we need to do is figure out not just so much where these areas are, but then how we want to treat them based on balancing the goals of the Act. We're requiring no net loss and no degradation of water in all three. It's how we do that changes in the zones.
I have a suggestion for a second bullet under this number 5. Restoration of groundwater quantity and quality shall be accomplished where possible. So I think this is the area where we're going to have the most degraded
for number 5.
Okay. So we should have an established policy to move towards that through these various development applications that come in or plans that move ahead on the municipal level.
Tracy, the only thing that comes to my mind when you say that is that the potential for particularly quality issues will come up here, too. I don't know if this is something, and again, based on what Michael said earlier, we want to add all three. That would be based on
quantity and quality.
Right. No, I understand, but Michael was talking, when he was talking about the three verbs in the Act for water resources to protect, restore, enhance.
Mm-hmm.
I understand your point that this may be the opportunity in the redevelopment to do it,
mm-hmm.
but basically getting back to Michael's point, and I'll ask him to confirm for me that that's the case, this may be something we may want to add to all three zones.
Oh,
to get back
fine.
To the verbiage, yeah.
To,
that's
to
that's
add to all three
the
zones.
Verbs, not the verbiage, I'm
the
sorry.
Concept, and the reason I'm suggesting is because just to make sure you don't have a net loss doesn't get you anywhere. We're just making the status quo
right.
What we're always going to have. And so mm-hmm. we have to reach further and make sure we go beyond, not just having low net.
Could you give me a real-life practical example of what Tracy just, or maybe Tracy can, what you envision there?
Well, for instance,
trying to figure out how that would encumber.
Well, if you have a development application that comes in and they're showing that they're not losing any groundwater volume, well, you require a BMP that actually adds more water back than was originally on that degraded site. For instance, if you have an application come in and the land use cover is urban, then you have very little recharge in that site now. However, if you used the numbers associated with forest, you would be requiring a higher amount of water to be recharged. So then you would be getting back some of what's lost. Same way with quality. If you require BMPs that enhance the quality, such as a bioretention system, rather than simply an infiltration basin or a system that does not enhance quality at all, we'll be getting back some of the quality that was already lost at that urban site. So if we are always just saying we have to show no net loss, we have to show that we're not making it worse, we're just putting in stone and assuring that we're going to be keeping in place the degraded condition that's already there because that urban condition is degraded. So we have to have a higher standard.
I thought that's what you meant. I'm just not sure that I'm comfortable in every instance of land disturbance building in that kind of a cost factor, that kind of an engineering effort to go beyond what is there already. I think going to slam down development where you want to have development, I'm trying to picture what's actually going to happen on the sites.
I think it is, Debbie. I think it is, because I can give you a very concrete example of things after 8 years on the planning board. Two things we would require were possible use of pervious pavement versus less pervious pavement.
That I could agree with.
And also, putting the
retention
roof drains going into the ground instead of the roof drains going into the driveway.
And they're not necessarily
simple things
more
like
expensive.
That.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
As a matter of fact, a lot of these are gimmicks.
Right.
They're added value.
Exactly. And they're very simple to do. They're all part of the low impact development standards that we're working on. And there's many of those things we can do that actually some of them will save them money. And also, I think Tracy mentioned things that may be more complicated, like a bioretention basin. But again, if you look at the long-term cost of that, maintenance and all kinds of other things, in many cases, those are less expensive over the long haul. So for a larger project, if it's a brownfield redevelopment,
but we're not going to put a number on it. We're not going to say we must affect 10%. We're just going to say let's have a positive.
I said accomplish what possible. We could, work on that and make it stronger.
That's practicable.
Sorry.
I'm saying we're the most practicable.
Well, I know there's a lot of members who are really hammering down that we hit all the numbers. I just, on this one particular, something struck me as not being a place where I would like to apply a number since we're now going beyond what's there already.
Quite frankly, I think that some of these, the things that were mentioned before, the pervious pavers and, having the stormwater from the roofs go into the ground. I think we should be encouraging this everywhere, not just in prime groundwater recharge areas.
Sure.
So I think that there should be somewhere where we do this all the time.
And I think they're incorporated in what we're looking at as low impact development standards.
Right now they just twist developers' arms and beg them because they don't get a lot of legal support to do these things or require this stuff.
And it's standard practice for a lot of places just to have those negotiations, but not everywhere. Yeah.
Right.
So does the staff think that the policy discussion I hear is that the plan ought to promote the evaluation of opportunities to restore groundwater recharge capacity across the region? And is that policy reflected in this paper and where? And
we just added.
I think we're proposing to add that in based on the comments.
I'm just trying to put a finer point on it and capture it because I think there are suggestions that are coming from the council that aren't in the paper that are probably doable, good ideas, as you just said.
I've got the verbs protect, restore, enhance, and highlighted and starred, and I think we need to go back and determine how we need to incorporate those in here.
Lisa, why don't you explain the rest of the policies?
Sure. Okay, moving on. Where do we stop? Number six? Thank you. Okay. The staff is recommending that the following resource protection standards be included in the RMT. Again, these are things that happen when the application is reviewed, as we discussed just a little while ago. Bullet number one under number six is to restrict development activities and new land uses within these areas. Bullet number two is to require inclusion of a prime groundwater recharge area within any municipal zoning and land use ordinances. And number three is to establish minimum standards for development. Again, we're getting back to the low-impact development and other BMPs within these zones. And this, again, is going to be that site-specific where the rubber meets the road kind of things. And once we've determined that, you know, the top 40% or whatever it is will get the greatest consideration, that'll help us. It'll help the towns. It'll help us identify where we need to do this most. It's basically the point.
I'll just point out, restrict is yet another verb.
Great. Great.
Okay. More squishy. All right. Recommendation number seven, at the bottom of the page. Staff's recommending following SMART design standards for inclusion in the RMP. Bullet number one is establishing minimum site design guidelines and permissible uses. Again, this is getting into more detail than we can talk about today, but we are working on that. Under that is letter A, to not allow an increase in pre-existing impervious area, no net loss to groundwater, or degradation in water quality. Bullet B.
Excuse me.
Yes.
The rest of that paragraph. Why do we have that in there? Increases in pre-existing impervious area shall be. This is a policy. I don't agree with it being in there, but not that we should gloss over. I think we should discuss it.
Okay.
If you just want to describe it and say what the rationale is.
Okay, I think this gets back somewhat to allowing us flexibility in dealing with conservation protection and redevelopment zones, Tracy. We're trying to, again, going back to the basis of no net loss or degradation in quality, and then we're going to have to talk with restoration enhancement in a later version. We're looking to basically put in a tiers. It's like the first thing is we don't want you to do any increase in impervious. We don't want you to do clearing. We're not good. That's the first point. But if we need to, because it's a development area, if we need to, because for every other purpose under the sun, it makes sense to develop this area for 14 different reasons we may be able to give you, then we can say, all right, then you have to do either BMPs or engineering to protect within the watershed, if not within the site. You have to be able to protect the water quality and water quality. And this allows us to play a little bit with the balancing act that we have to do, because it's not just protection. We have to look at growth and other issues. So this is just meant to retain the flexibility that the council has and the staff has in reviewing these applications, where it may be, for example, a small reduction or recharge. We can tell them to do the things we talked about as those concrete examples to protect recharge. And we have a win-win. I would hesitate to take out that flexibility as much as I understand your point. We're charged with that balancing act, and it's if the council has specifics that they want to have included in this, we're more than open to them. But again, we're trying to balance it out and provide some level of flexibility, again, at your discretion. I mean, what gets approved or not is ultimately going to be at your discretion. But these decisions are better off at a site-specific level.
I think it's confusing. If I understand this right, it's confusing two things. What the smart design standards are saying, in effect, it's policy 7, is if you conformed to policies 1 through 6 or 2 through 6 and development is allowable based on what's been said before, then it must conform to these standards. Right?
Yes.
So by then, in this one, trying to sort of repeat or summarize when development could be permissible in a groundwater recharge area, it's confusing because you're using similar but not identical language, and I think if I understand it right, it would be better to say it that way.
Yeah, I agree it's confusing, and also I'm not sure from what you just said that I understand what you are trying to say in that second sentence. It seemed to me that you were saying in the second sentence you were kind of equivocating what you said in the first sentence. In other words, what you're saying in the first sentence is you can't increase the impervious area if it's going to hurt things. And then in the second sentence you're saying you can hurt things as long as you use LIDs. I know I'm oversimplifying, but it seems like that's what you're saying. I'm saying I don't think it's necessary to hurt things. I think we can use BMPs and LIDs that accomplish the first standard. So I think we're going too far. And I think that even in the stormwater regulations, they make, you know, it's made very clear that we have the technical ability to accomplish the goal of not hurting the resource, even if we are developing. So why do we have to accept that we can hurt the resource and have a net loss? That's my point. Why accept that? I don't think we need to. And smart design should be the smartest.
Lisa, excuse me, before you answer the question, hold on to it. What is an LID?
We like them. We just don't.
Low impact development VOP.
They are specific standards that are developed that we're evaluating. We're using as a placeholder for
like pervious, pervious pavers, wet gardens. They'll come at a later date.
Thank you, David.
Everything's in the glossary.
Tracy, just one thing I would suggest in my reading of this, we basically are saying we may allow for an increase in impervious cover, but only if they demonstrate that there is no harm. Mm-hmm. We're not allowing harm. We may allow something to happen on the ground that can prove there's no harm. And that's really specific for this. Again, recharge is a little bit different because there's ways to preserve quality and quantity but allow land use change. It may not be the best way to do it. It may not be the most preferred way that the council wants to do it.
We should take out the second sentence then. I see the point of saying we can have a net loss because, I mean, after all, this is the Water Protection and Planning Act. So
we're not saying we're allowing a net loss. We're saying we're allowing impervious cover as long as they make up for it and prove to us that it doesn't hurt things. It's both.
And I would say take out the second sentence.
I think the top of page four where it starts with increases
seven
in. Increases
I'm
in pre existing.
I'm agreeing with Tracy on that, using the admonition when in doubt.
If I could just provide a clarification, maybe where the first sentence says that you cannot increase impervious area if you can't provide no net loss to groundwater recharge. The second sentence is implied to say that where increases are allowed because you can provide for no net loss, that you cannot that you have to demonstrate that there's no harm through use of BMPs.
It doesn't say that clearly.
Yes, I think that's what if we
read that.
Clarify the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think based on John's comment, which is right, is that's explaining what the smart design the standards are. It's basically if you get through six so you can do something, whatever development you're allowed would have to meet additional criteria. And then the first one would be no net loss. The second would be no harm. The third would be LIDs or BMPs. And then the fourth one might be restoration. So those are all of the requirements, the conditions that would come if you're allowed. And we can clean that up.
We can clarify.
That's not what Lisa said. At least what I heard her say was that these are standards that apply only in the specially planned areas. So
no.
Are these standards that apply to all? Okay.
Yeah, better.
I'm here a lot.
I don't think I talked about specially planned areas under number 7. So.
Okay. So these are design standards that apply to any development that ultimately is allowed in a recharge area.
Correct.
Okay, well, let's go into H.
Just a clarification. Somebody said out loud, right? I think it was you, Lisa, said prove to us. But we really mean prove to a planning board that's come in conformance with our. It does seem to me that's useful to keep reminding oneself of because it may drive some of your thinking about language.
Got it. Well, I just 2 points on that. One is, I think the standard that's in here is a terrible standard. I don't know how. You talk about no discernible harm. If you really trying to establish a standard that a planning board in particular, we all know have ranks of hydrogeologists available to them, are not going to be able to meet that or assess that standard. So, and I'm not sure it's the right standard. I mean, the anti-degradation policies and the water quality standards talk about no measurable changes, you know, in C1. So that's a problem if you're suggesting to use that language as the demonstration standard. And secondly, to Michael's point, the idea that this demonstration is going to be made to a municipal planning board and that they're going to have the capacity to evaluate it and make that judgment, I think, is a question we ought to ask because I don't think that capacity is there.
I think for volume it may be, Tim.
What's that?
Based on what is already in the stormwater rules, for volume it may be. I agree. For quality, it's more difficult. because the stormwater rules require them to do just this kind of a volume check.
Well, I remember the question as to what, and you know, Tracy's in a little different than I am, but how well their stormwater management programs are working at the municipal level.
Well, I think there are some that are working, but I think the volume question is a thorny issue, and we need to discuss that further, because DEP only requires a certain portion of that volume to be recharged, not the evaporated and transpired portion. So I think, and they have this definition of different.
And that gets to enhancement. That may be where we go to enhancement to get that.
I think it's a very complex, thorny issue, and we need to get into that probably. I don't know if this is the place to get into that. I think we need to get into it, though. I would think when we develop our guidance and manuals. But I don't want to go into 8 yet. I hope you're going to go through B and C, because I just have one suggestion in C before we leave 7.
What's that?
Okay. On 7, I would suggest that the second sentence where you say these BMPs would seek to maximize groundwater recharge, I would also add, and we should always add when we're talking about this, and protect, improve water quality. And then where we're reading on there, through site design standards, including, I think you mean, but not limited
yes.
to?
Right. Yes. Okay. I have that big bold red on here that we added.
Thank you.
To add back the not limited to, yes.
Right. Okay. So because I think we get into a problem here when we start listing things. You list 2 things and we got to list 10 things.
Sure.
So I think it would be better not to even say, but not limited to.
Right.
I think we should have that in the manual separate, and we're going to get into trouble if we start making lists.
Okay. Just like it. Tim, you know, you were saying that, you know, municipalities don't have hydrologists and all on staff. That's true, but they can demand that an applicant have a hydrological report prepared, and then they can actually charge the applicant for the municipality getting somebody who is a hydrologist to verify or review it.
Yeah. I guess I learned long ago that you just have to keep an eye towards implementation when you design policy. And all I'm saying is we should not create requirements or strategies that are going to demand a lot of capacity that's not necessarily there. I mean, you're right. They may be able to address it that way. You may get good consultants, good competing consultants that give you enough information to resolve it. But we're building in that burden. And I just think we ought to think about that as to how effective that's going to be to meet our goal ultimately in the way
we do. You know, we have the same consideration. How does the planning board know that the steep slopes have been measured appropriately, or a lot of these other resources evaluated appropriately? To some degree, we have to hope that the municipalities are smart enough to get the right input.
Well, either that or when we design, as we go through and finalize this, we keep an eye towards framing the policies and the requirements and the standard in a way that are much more easily implemented than, you know, successive analyses, successive things. And I think I agree with you that that's endemic throughout a lot of these recommendations, that it pushes a lot down. Sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes not. Sometimes it's necessary for flexibility, like in redevelopment, when you're not sure exactly what you're dealing with. But as an overarching principle, we ought to be having clear, predictable, you know, to whether you agree with them or not, non-debatable standards. You should say, do this, don't do that. And and I don't know that that idea has made its way into all of this yet.
Are we done with number 7?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on to number 8. The staff's recommending the following regional growth standards for incorporation in the RMP. The first bullet under number 8 is to require regional stormwater, and these two are very much related, requiring that regional stormwater and wetland management plans and the fact that the towns have to participate in them allows us to deal with both these wetland and stormwater issues cohesively and on a regional scale. We're basically saying you have to have it, you have to participate. So it gets at it from both angles. It's not just, you know, you have to do it and then you have to participate in it. You can't just ignore it. So we get a better and more cohesive plan, and it gets us to a more regional scale to deal with these issues.
Are we saying that needs to be part of a municipality's master plan?
Yes, as part of their planning efforts to develop.
Probably should. Make it. This isn't a separate, it may be a separate requirement, but we want to put into their master plan. So say that out loud.
Okay.
Would this apply only to commercial development or to residential as well, in furtherance of economic economic development? Are we talking about commercial development?
And any development in this case that would result in loss of recharge rates through increase in impervious area.
So it's not limited to economic goals.
What's that?
It's not limited to economic goals.
No.
That's what you're saying. To encourage appropriate economic development opportunity for that.
Right, and that's because it's limited to the regional growth standards. So where there's growth, there are provisions to accommodate or encourage that growth and still provide for protection of the resource.
Just growth in general.
What's that? Growth in general. Because remember, on regional growth standards, we're encouraging growth. So it gets to Scott's issue, what's practical? Part of making use of land more efficient and eliminating the burden on the individual landowner is to require, encourage these regional management plans and restoration strategies. That there are abilities for towns including it in a requirement. We have then the ability to grant to municipalities that are within the growth area to secure the necessary professional services to develop these plans according to our guidelines.
So just sort of legislative intent, litigation strategies. Do we intend, with respect to regional stormwater and wetland management, to be requiring potentially somebody to go beyond the current requirements of state and federal law?
This stands independently of existing state and federal law.
So the answer is yes?
It's independent of. We're not asking to go beyond it because there's no...
So the answer is no. Here, Steve, just to walk on down the road a little bit. If we're thinking about saying you need to do more than what's currently required, that's great. I mean, then I understand what we're saying. Well, may or may not be great, but then I know what we're saying. Look, a municipality is going to come in and say, I want to know what this means. Does it mean I need to go beyond what's currently required? And if we say yes, I think in fairness to them, we have to tell them, is it something that we're going to develop over the next 6 months or for what? So that's why I'm asking the question.
It would be beyond existing requirements.
And then it seems to me that's a question for this council, whether we want to do that.
I don't know if we want to do acres at all. And the second bullet, require participation in regional programs?
It's regional planning.
What programs are there?
No. Should one, it says where applicable, should a municipality during conformance identify the opportunities to develop regional stormwater approaches to deal with water quality issues, groundwater recharge issues, and the council approves it, then any development activity that results in the requirement to, let's say in this case, provide no net loss of recharge, and there's a regional facility that they must participate in that regional facility. So it's very similar to a municipality that makes roadway improvements and establishes or extends a sewer line and says that if you're going to take advantage of that traffic improvement, transportation improvement, or take advantage of the sewer, that you have to participate in offsetting the costs incurred with providing that public service. This is the same concept.
I just want to say I'm concerned that the municipalities, even though we give them some grant money, it still is more stuff they have to be overseeing and tracking. I'm just concerned that we're going to put a burden on the towns that will keep them from buying into this. You have to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. I went back a couple minutes ago. Looked at the act again, and just to remind us that the conformance period is 9 to 15 months.
9 to 15.
But there is a 60-day period in which we have to act if somebody comes to us. It's like the federally mandated 6-month criminal trial thing. I think we ought to bear in mind with some of these. I don't know where I come out on these two, or maybe there are three or four embedded in these two, where I come out, but it does seem to me that, you know, the municipality might want to come forward relatively quickly and say, yeah, I'm meeting your standards, and we need to be able to tell them in 60 days why they're not. And I'm not sure that you want to necessarily bite this much off at the get-go. And if you guys have thought that through, great, and if not, please think it through.
There's another provision in that 9 to 15 months. It says approve, disapprove, or approve with conditions. So it is very likely that a municipality would be approved with conditions, and those conditions require continued planning exercises towards meeting some of these long-term requirements.
Yeah, but I think we have to tell them what the conditions are.
Yes.
And to tell them that we're going to tell them later.
Conformance, which may
not work.
Yes.
I don't think it will work. And even if it does work, I don't think it's right.
Well, I have a suggestion, for both of these bullets, that we should make it clear that this is where applicable, because whereas it's a great idea to have regional planning, I'm involved in a regional stormwater plan right now on this steering committee one, and it's really a work in progress. I mean, this is not, these are not panaceas.
No, absolutely not.
Stormwater plans. Same thing with, well, I mean, of course, we're taking a regional approach, but I think we should make it clear that this is where applicable, and that we're not requiring and telling, and also to come in and tell a town you must work with your next door town and you share a Hub 14 with them in order to make a stormwater plan, in order to be in conformance. I mean, I think that the more important things is to make sure that our, you know, the standards are being met, and the big important goals of protecting the resource are being met. And I don't necessarily think we get there through more regional, intermunicipal plans, unless it comes from the bottom up. So I think that the will has to be there for that one. And this is more, to me, a method than a standard. So we're talking about regional growth standards, but these are sort of methods or ways to get to it. So I don't think it's exactly appropriate. And I would suggest also, in the discussion of these, we bring up this restoration language. Perhaps it's be more appropriate under here to have a bullet talking about restoring and enhancing. And then also, I was noticed that the bullet was missing here on the LID and the BMPs. I don't know if that was just an oversight, but it seems like that's one of the most important things to say on the regional growth standards.
I suggest that you go back and think about whether there's value added to this policy, number 8, to begin with, and whether it's implementable in any reasonable period of time.
I'd just like to add one other thing that you are probably aware of. Municipalities are still in the throes of trying to implement their mandated, state-mandated regional stormwater plans, which, by the way, is costing them a tremendous amount of money to do that, to implement those plans. And some of them are not even doing it yet. You know, there were tiers, certain types of towns where they have a C1 implication, they had to do it first. And then others have to kick in to do them. So there's only so much they're
going to
do.
Yeah, let's let somebody else be blamed for that one. So, Tom, just a process question, a procedure question. Do you have this last clause in your subject to review of the Highlands Council? Was that a contemplation of subject to review and approval in the master plan conformance phase?
No,
or is it separate and apart?
Yes, in the conformance phases, the planning documents that are required, we would approve.
I'd probably strike it then, because you don't need it if something like this stays.
We can sure pre-conformance and conformance.
I just want to go back to Jack's question a little bit, which is, explain to me again what triggers a regional growth standard. I understand that we've established policy that when a town conforms, that growth-related policies are optional, right? Mm-hmm. So is there something, are you trying to figure out whether or not there's something that if there's a big mall that gets proposed or something along those lines, when does this kick in?
The regional growth standards are largely specific to regional growth areas. including specially planned areas. I think that's one situation where regional growth standards are limited to a zone. Where smart design applies to all uses across all zones, regional growth is more specific to the regional growth or regional development zone, or specially planned areas, where growth is being encouraged. And it's the many of the policy recommendations under regional growth is to encourage more efficient uses of land and greater development and economic growth potential within those areas that are otherwise appropriate for development.
Well, then one, and I don't know where this fits in the coordination consistency or the future planning stuff, but I have to think that there probably is a lot of value to regional wetlands protection management programs, stormwater management programs, but that it's fairly new art. And to go to Mimi's question, if we're really talking about trying to go back and manage or redesign already built areas, right, whether they're regional growth areas or especially planned areas, that there's a lot of work needs to be done to develop how that's done and then figure out an effective way to get it to those implementing bodies, municipalities and counties, and support them in doing that. And that's the strategy we ought to be thinking about here. This is framed, at least I took it to be, if you come into a project that's in, speaks to that part of it, participating in those plans, and really, from a management perspective, we ought to be thinking about how we build up the capacity of people to do those kind of plans in those specific areas. And that's probably going to bear us more fruit down the road than the way this is structured now.
We'll work on the language.
Moving on to number 9. The staff recommending the following pre-conformance strategy to be incorporated into the RNP. There's only one. We're talking about developing technical guidelines and procedures for low-impact development and other BMPs like those for artificial recharge to protect and restore prime groundwater recharge areas. We need to add enhance here, Michael.
Yep.
Okay. That's the recommendation for number 9. Moving on to number 10.
I'm sorry, just one. But your list of technical guidelines and procedures would also include defining allowable uses?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Would it include a list of allowable uses?
Right, because you're talking about, you talk about the standards for allowing the development in these areas, which is what this guidelines are supposed to help protect at least. I don't know.
I'm still,
without a list
is
what you guys envision as low-impact design and BMPs,
and
it's
hard to...
Yes, and that's
coming.
So.
Yes, you said
uses,
specific uses?
No. Well, these things, we shouldn't be building new or redeveloping new industrial uses in prime groundwater recharge areas, or if we're redeveloping, I think the use question comes into this at some point. Then the LID and the best management practices are basically bells and whistles hung on those uses, so how you do the use. So.
So, Steve, what was your answer?
I'm sorry, I was answering to the question of the list of low impact development BMPs. In terms of specific uses, I think generally any use that results in an increase in impervious area that would otherwise harm or impair a groundwater recharge would be prohibited. That's, I think, what the intended use restriction is. So any increase beyond existing impervious.
But all the guidelines are applicable to activities that we're saying are allowed, right? Because a prohibition, you don't need guidelines for it. You just say you're not allowed to do it, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Right. So right. You don't need a design standard to do nothing.
Right.
We can add clarifying language.
Number 10, conformance strategies being recommended by staff include requiring the inclusion of prime groundwater recharge areas in municipal and or county conformance documents, master plans, zoning and land use ordinances as appropriate. And this is to have a means to address the issue of groundwater recharge in the land use planning on a local level. That's basically what we're looking at here for conformance.
But we will provide them with recommended
ordinances and everything. Yes. Yes.
So that's essentially the conformance strategy for every policy.
Right.
Yes.
And just basically saying it, recharge is one of those issues that we're going to have in there.
It just seemed 10 should be 9 and 9 should be 10. Right?
We're following that form.
I understand. I guess the larger point is I'm hearing questions that I know are answered further in the document or elsewhere in the document. And I don't know if we could provide links or references or citations from one place to the other, but there's so much interaction here between all of the provisions in the Act, the provisions of the provisions of the law. If you search hard enough, you'll find it. Right?
I understand your point about switching 9 and 10. I'm looking at it. I understand that one would follow the other.
But Debbie's right, too. This is the format. You're following the sequence of events.
When you all recommend the inclusion of the prime groundwater recharge areas, you also recommend the inclusion of the prime groundwater area protection standards. Under 6 in the resource protection standards, you have a recommendation to require inclusion of the protection standards within the municipal zoning. So that would carry through to conformance.
Yes.
Right.
You are correct.
Put those in the municipal ordinances if they're going to uphold them.
Lisa, could you go through 11, 12, and 13
sure.
in the next 4 minutes?
Sure. Number 11 is the 5-year resource protection and planning goals that are being recommended. This is similar to what we talked about earlier in terms of coordinating programs with other government and nonprofit agencies to leverage funding and the activities to better protect groundwater recharge. Bullet number 2 under number 11, again, is to develop guidelines and procedures. To advance these things, and also the focus of this is that, to develop procedures that can be implemented on a local and a regional scale, because both are necessary for recharge. You have to do it both locally and regionally. So that would be the caveat on bullet number 2.
I have about enhancing.
Okay.
Yeah, we were all going to raise our hands.
Back to verbs again, right?
Right.
Okay.
And another one is where you have in the second line after the comma and other methods. And then you go on the third line of protecting. I would just add in there other methods of measuring and protecting, just because the science is developing on that, and it would be something worthy for us to look into over the next 5 years as we move forward.
Okay. Moving on to number 12, coordination and consistency considerations being recommended by staff include development of a coordinated regulatory review program with DEP and other state agencies. Under bullet number 1, and this is to ensure consistency of any number of actions that they may take that may interact with what we need to do here as a body, and also to investigate further what other programs could be leveraged and what we need to coordinate to protect groundwater recharge. This is obviously not an exhaustive list. Bullet number 2 under number 12 is to coordinate with NRCS and other federal agencies in order to protect recharge, and again, we need to investigate that further. There's any number of opportunities with USGS, the Army Corps, EPA, and others to work on these things together, and we need to really flesh out that list. We're familiar with a number of them, but we need to flesh out that list. Number 13, local participation considerations that are being recommended by staff include education and technical training for local officials and others like nonprofit organizations involved in this issue. On the importance of the resource in question, the necessary standards and BMPs that will protect recharge, to allow them to understand why it's important and what they can do to help us and help themselves in protecting their own recharge potential. So we go through just the education process and feed that back into the loop with them. And that was number 13. And a little more than 4 months.
Let's take a half hour and then
come
back at
2:00. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you. Thank you. See you survived. I must be healed. Yeah.
Looking
Tyrolean.
Yeah,
I'm not sure of the overall
I am.
No, I don't think so. Is everybody playing?
Man can wear a child is called. Knows who he is.
That's right. He's the real man.
He's a real man.
That's right.
Very nice.